And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. There are two banquets today. The next one in 4 hours from now will be with the Australasian. But first, I'm here with three Irish guys, and we're going to discuss events in Ireland this year. So Garrod Murphy and has been on Millennial several times. Gran Torino has been on for the first time this year. And Peter from The Receipts, this is his debut. So welcome. Actually, Peter, do you want to introduce yourself briefly since it is your first time?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. Some people may know me from years ago. I was called The Don on YouTube, basically. I had a channel in 2016 in the heyday, basically. But basically, yeah, I went, I kind of decided to restructure what I was kind of doing, basically, around the COVID time, basically. And so I relaunched, basically, kind of a new brand or whatever, The Receipts. And basically, that will be kind of, well, what it is I do a lot of writing, a lot of it's Substack based. And I'm going into streaming again this year a bit more frequently, maybe every 2 weeks or so. And so it'll be all about Ireland, but also kind of global matters and broader, you know, philosophical kind of concepts and ideas, basically, behind what's
it's
going
funny.
On, basically, what we're dealing with. You know.
Right, yeah, good. It's funny how many people have taken a similar sort of arc where live streamers, but then they go to Substack, and then that in turn sort of re-energizes their streaming work. It's and the Substack ends up being sort of integrated into that in some way. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think actually a lot of it is because, you know, when you're in the YouTube kind of format, you're kind of doing videos, you're discussing topics or whatever, and there's nothing better than like writing your ideas down. Like if you can't really, like, you know the way people say, like, you can't actually understand something until you go write about it, and you think you understand something until you try to write it down on paper, so to speak, and then you realize, geez, I actually don't understand this at all the way I thought it.
Yeah.
You know? So
that's when the blind spots appear.
Yeah. Yeah, it forces you to basically sharpen your axe. You know what I mean? And you have to be precise. You can't be saying things that are inaccurate. You know, it just forces you to get better. And then it's like it makes your content better, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Well, I'm hoping to get back into live streaming regularly next year, because I've done 2 years on Substack, and it's, and I want to definitely continue that. But now start talking about current stuff again on live stream. So welcome also Garrod and Rowan from Gran Torino. Keith Woods was supposed to be joining us, and he might still, but he's got a technical problem. He might drop in briefly, but he won't be here for the full duration for sure. It's a shame, but we've got three charming Irish guys with the gift of the gab to keep things going. Garrod, since it's been a while since you appeared on Millennial, why don't you start us off with some roundabout thoughts of Ireland in 2025?
Well, I myself have kind of been away a little bit. Not like, you know, the way people announce a departure from activism and content. I don't really do that. I just kind of come and go sometimes. I've been a bit fallow for a while. I've been observing, but not really creating content, but just said I'd drop that in. So I've been kind of in the shadows, kind of watching, tweeting a little bit, but nothing major. But to your question, like, and I agree with the Don as well, and you about writing. I find as well you can remember everything better. Like if you write an essay, you'll remember it almost verbatim for years. So I agree with you on that. But yeah, I usually live stream. Haven't been doing much of that either. In terms of Ireland, the last year, this is the Irish banquet. In a way, I don't even, and this is the trouble of not writing enough, is that I struggle sometimes to comprehend, because it's a big question. It's like, how do you feel about almost everything that's going on? obviously immigration, this, that, and the other. I sort of feel a bit of stasis in the sense of this is not a very good thing to do on a live stream. We're meant to be infotaining people. But I was actually chatting to someone earlier about coming on and the very question you're asking me, and I found myself kind of, and I don't mean to like piss all over the concept of having a live stream, but I found myself kind of feeling almost nihilistic about it. Like everything that can be said has been said. I don't know if any more of you, any others of you get that. Like in 2016, it felt novel. All these things were happening and we talking about the things that are happening in our society and breaking it down and the hidden truths and all of that was great. But now we've kind of said that. It was worth saying, but it's been said, and it sometimes feels a bit like spinning wheels. And there is always more to be said and more to be added, but there's that thing of like headbutting the wall a little bit. Like, look, I think a lot of society actually does get it. So what do you do when nothing changes, even with that being the case? Let's say on issues like migration, 80% or whatever, depending on the poll of Irish people, want it stopped. So I don't need to tell them anymore. But the question is, okay, what now? I don't know. You know, it's such a huge question. What do you do? What to say next? That's just my general feeling.
Oh, yeah. But 80% does seem like a great achievement. Rowan, sorry, interrupted.
No, not at all. I was just going to agree with Gerard as well. And Peter said the same thing as well. It's a cycle. I stepped away for the last 8 months. I only recently returned. Because I was fully expecting just to go back on Rumble. I was still being streaming. I was carrying on my show on Rumble, Twitch, and the alternatives after the ban on YouTube. And it was very much deflatory, but at the same time, it was cathartic as well, because it was the swiping of the typewriter. It was a reset that I needed, because I was on a 6-7 year run. Garrod, you remember when we were out and like just doing live streams, covering all the protests that were starting and trying to drive the conversation. You remember, I brought it up in the live stream as well, 2012, down in Listowel-Varna, when Listowel-Varna got its first little tranche. We went down to visit and the paper started talking about, that's when the far right were moving in dark circles and trying to coerce people. But that cycle, as you said, Gerard and Peter, you do need that period of time to step away, because you take a lot on board yourself. In your own mind, you know, am I doing enough? Are people getting the information? As the information comes to me, my thing was a whole infograph. Just get that information out. You discern yourself. I'll do my best to quantify the sources. I bring them in because I don't want to mislead. Citizen journalism is very much a brand new tranche of journalism, and it's not far from accepted. It's seen as activism. And but the breakaway was needed. For me, I went off and did a journalism course online. But I find, for me, I know you two guys like to write, I find the whole process very, I hate sticking labels and stuff for that, but my attention span is minute. So whether that's ADHD or anything like that, I find the written word cumbersome for me. And I agree with you, Peter, the more you write it down, the more it sticks and it sharpens your epistemology. You know, as you say, how do you know, come to know what you know? And you have to keep checking in on that. But we spent the last, I did, 6, 7, 8 years in that process, just screaming, getting the streams out, getting whatever event was happening, get it published to drive the narrative. And then when we start getting mentioned in the papers over here, self, Gerald, even Peter, and as the nebulous activists online, there was a feedback on what you were doing. Were you being effective? Are we being effective as to make them start talking about the talking points that we've done, to the point of saturation now where they're talking our talking points, they're talking everything that's said. And again, I garnish this from online, from researching abroad and coming into contact with that. But I think it's essential for people, even those that are starting now and raising, you know, like Michael McCarthy over here for us, and Michael O'Keefe, online big names. I'm sure they're going to find it at a time where they're going to have to sit and reset and take a breather from it, because it's that constant, drive in your brain. It's just draining. But my point being, I think we're all coming back at a similar point in time to come back to that streaming. And I think that streaming was where it is very effective. It's very time consuming to do the video edits and run a script and brought it through when you're running your 9 to 5. The idea being, and I'll cut it short, that when the ban came, it took away the income flow for our own work to perpetuate ourselves. And when the YouTube channel was banned, it hobbles you and it takes you out. I restarted my construction business. I went back out on the tools. I started from scratch. I pushed brushes till I got myself back in a meaningful state. And now that I won't fully depend, if the channel does get monetized or the situation comes again, I won't fully stick on that and allow it to kind of just take hobble the knees off me. So I'm enthused to have the second chance to come back on YouTube. I'll try not play by their rules, but I won't allow the channel to go down just for a hyperbole and hyperbolic speech, you know?
Yeah. Do you find that social media can be like, I know you're saying it's tiresome and everything. I agree. Like I actually don't like social media that much personally, you know, like I use it, but like, I need to step away from it. Like I couldn't be like constantly on it all day, you know, it's just like a big cycle of bad news mainly. Mm. And I think there's a thing where you end up in social media where you're stuck in a kind of you're stuck on someone else's cycle. Because it's all algorithmic. Everything is kind of like gamified in some way. You're constantly scrolling through the doom feed, you know. And I mean, I just find like I'm actually weary of social media because I actually think a lot of social media is crap. You know what I mean? Like I know, like I do actually like the process of streaming. Like it can be very rewarding to be just talking with someone in a conversation. Like I actually like it. And it is a job. Like I think people should be rewarded for putting that time, because I know what goes into making a good stream. You know, the kind of research you have to do. You have to have something interesting to say. You have to have a bit of dynamism. You know, it's a skill set, you know. But like I think that a lot of the I'm actually weary of like where X is going, even. Like I'm kind of worried that like a lot of the populist stuff, I don't like it that much, you know, like it seems very artificial. I'm very weary of some of these narratives that get attached to it. And you're kind of going, am I just in a kind of an American-centered kind of thing that's kind of bringing, that's taking what was an organic kind of nationalist kind of thing or in our country, you know? And I'm kind of weary that it gets brought into something else, you know? And you're not really in control of it then, you know? You're reacting to someone else's news. You're reacting to this. You have to have an opinion on something that happened in America 3 hours ago. Do you know what I mean? You have to have a hot take on it. And it's like, I think a lot of social media is just people having a hot take on something. And then it just stops there. The thoughts, the analysis ends and we move on to the next thing and the next thing, you know, like I've seen stories like that I thought would have been really big stories this year. And there was one about like, it was that documentary that was brought out about the Irish, and it was associated with like DC, was it DCU? I think it was. And there was a whole interesting story where they're, you know, a big propaganda documentary about the Irish, what our roots are. And oh, it turns out we're actually not that pure after all. And like that story, just like it, for about a day on social media in Ireland, people were talking about it like, oh, isn't this terrible, you know? And it just disappeared. And 4 episodes came out and no one talked about it. And there's all these interesting connections about who made the series, who did all this. You know, you could look at it and really tear it apart. And I was kind of going, geez, no one is talking about this. Do you know what I mean? And people just moved on to the next thing and it's gone. And I worry that a lot of the kind of populist thing is just light switch brain. It just keeps people just moving along and they're not really developing ideas the way they should, you know. They're not really developing their own consciousness but what they want, but what this is really about, like, you know, which is really about becoming who you are, becoming who, you know, what do we want our countries to be. And it's got nothing to do with Musk. It's got nothing to do with Zionism or whatever stuff is it's getting packaged with, you know what I mean? So I just, yeah, that's maybe just a negative attitude, but you know, I'll put it out there.
No, I totally agree with all that, Don. Or sorry, Peter. I'm in the old
yeah, it's fine.
name. Yeah, but like you know, it's like it's a hard to describe feeling. It's like being stuck in the churn or stuck in the matrix. Maybe we're belaboring the whole discussion about the whole medium, but it feels like being in the matrix, especially X to me. If you ever get caught on the, you know, there's a tab for who you're following and then the other one, it gets worse. It's bad enough even for the ones you're following. It's bad overall. But when you get into the other one, it's awful. You really see the slop of something about a 600-year-old church. This is what they took from you and blah, blah, blah. It's just kind of, there's just something so intolerable about it. I can't stand
Roman statue avatars.
All of that. Like, it just seems so spinning its wheels. It seems so Matrix, psyop-y. And that's the other thing. Sometimes I do feel, because I spent so many years, and this is what bothers me, again, why I'm alienated a bit from the populist right, is that I spent so many years, one of my criticisms from early on was about the NGO complex, yada, yada, yada. State-funded narratives and outcomes, and how that's inherently sort of corrupt. It's not real. And I see, you know, with Musk and Trump and Populism Inc. and all of that creeping into Ireland in this strange way. Tommy Robinson, but Ireland, you know, that kind of thing. It's so obvious. It's so pointless in a way. It's like what's being achieved. It's like Plastic Paddy, like Populism Inc. And like, I get it. People do different things and all that. But for me, I just feel like, look, if we're able to point at NGOs and the lefties and how they're controlled there, when you go to a nominally right-wing person and you say, you know, there's certain elements of our thing could be a bit psyop-y as well. Can I explain to you my logic, if it makes sense? And some of these newbie populist right people are sort of going, no, 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 everybody on earth could be psyoped. The lefties are psyoped. Everybody's psyoped, but not me, because I know that Muslims are a danger and immigration is bad and et cetera, et cetera. And you go, okay, so you're unwilling, you know, you have to examine where you're at and what you are and what you say and what you see and qui bono and all of that stuff. And that was my principle coming into the NGOs and the lefties. And I'm almost more attached to that principle than I am to rah, 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 we all got our script type of thing. You know, the nationalism on paper. It's like I'm more attached actually to the principle of truth seeking and independence. And I think that's important. And then you see the X stuff, you see the plastic stuff, and you kind of go, you know, and it sort of feeds into the slight sense of alienation, maybe, I think, as well. I don't know.
You see that what Peter's saying there as well is the programming of the short attention span, and people now, TikTok and all that derivatives, your attention span, but then the next news cycle kicks in. Watching Lionel Nation there recently, he brought up the same subject as well, but in another way that it invokes more apathy from everybody else, is that the news cycle gives, like when Trump, he got assassinated, or he was attempted assassination attempt, and day two, maybe 2 days later, maximum, the news cycle moved on. We're on to the next thing. No follow-up, no accountability, no, you know, and there's certain news cycles that have come. And we're all very much in that. It's, as Peter says, it seems like the cleaner fish kind of scoop in behind the main break of the story, and they come in with the latest hot take to come in behind it so that they can get their view count up and stuff like that. It's superficial. And leaning back into Garrod as well, for me, it's always been about the truth seeking aspect of it. It's about just getting the information that the mainstream or the legacy of the VT prostitutes were not discussing and talking about, those sacred cows that they wouldn't touch. Like going down to Ross Lair and then seeing the direct provision centres and bringing them up on screen and showing people that they were moving out. But another causal effect of that program and training in regards to the empathy, he was speaking in regards to the Candace Owens things. I mean, keeping it contemporary and up to date, he's saying that should her an attempted life be made on her attempt in regards to the same way as Charlie Kirk, that it'll be pigeonholed the very next day, and people go, you know, she did talk some crazy stuff and things went way off the kilter, and sometimes didn't agree on other things, and then boom, the next news cycle comes in, she's forgotten about, populist rise forgets about it, nobody's held to account. We don't do deep dive investigations. The way it's all spilling out online at the moment in regards to that story with the Cork, all of that Cork fallout, again, is that another, you're looking at, is that another psyop? What are they not trying to talk about? You know, is it just a distraction from the war that's coming to a close end? The paper tiger of NATO is disintegrating and they're still talking about escalation and doubling down and dictating terms, even though they're on the losing side. Never before has the losing side dictated terms to the aggressor. It's not even an aggressor. But there's three tranches in that. It's the apathy, the over-apathy of people forgetting the news cycle and then not, you know, reaffirming the truth and speaking in the truth. That to me is all that really mattered, was the logos of it all. It was true in my interviews with E. Michael Jones, when I first transported with the Logos, and that became central to me then in the Christian faith then, is speaking the Logos and finding the reward, not in the material for the streaming, but in speaking God's word and speaking Logos and countering the narratives and the lies that were falling for us. But apathy is another thing we must be mindful of in ourselves as well, is and you know, just discard things like that when they do approach, you know.
I mean, I'm going to be extra conspiratorial here. Like, I mean, would you, I'm just going to throw it out there, like, do you think it's possible that, like, the reason that Musk bought X, for example, is to basically contain the right, you know? Like, I think that's highly likely, you know, although I actually think it's good in ways, you know, like the fact that people are brought. Yeah. But let's see, the way I look at it, a lot of technology now exists to basically manage this, you know, like, I think if you're going to blow up on X, like, I think you can be easily prevented or encouraged to blow up on X. Do you know what I mean? Now, you could say that's like a conspiracy theory, you know, but I mean, if you go back to the start of Twitter was always connected with the American establishment. Like, it was during the Arab Spring, it was being used to basically encourage these, you know, these movements, these whatever violent movements, basically all across the Middle East. So there's a long culture in American social media, like, they're all kind of connected. Like, these companies, either, you know, a lot of them directly come out of like the CIA, pretty much. You know what I mean?
No doubt. I
see, that's what I think, and maybe I'm just so cynical about things. Do you know what I mean? I've just seen so much of, like, I've looked at so much for the last 15 years at this point, like, that when I see, like, oh, Musk has bought Twitter and it's going to be based and all the base people are back, and then I'm looking at, well, certain people aren't back, you know, certain people aren't back, and I'm kind of going, like, why is that? Like, is there a watch list here? Is there some kind of list, you know? And then I'm like, you know, this populist thing just takes off. And it's like, listen, like, we had Trump in 2016. We had populism. We were all there for it. That was the time for Trumpism. Like, what's this? Like, why are we, this is 10 years later now at this point. And now it's like this wave is hitting Ireland now. Like, you know what I mean? And it's like, to me, that seems artificial. You know, I look at that and I go, is this a managed thing? Like, where you get people kind of, you know, you allow them to vent, you allow them to create a movement, and ultimately, it doesn't really go anywhere, because where can it go? You know, what's the vehicle that it's going to have to kind of take power or whatever? Do you know what I mean?
That's like, the big question. Let's say 100% of people in the country, even the foreigners, I don't know, have absorbed our message and the based message on Twitter, and they all agree. I suppose you could argue they could vote for a certain party. You know, it's complicated, but like the electoral politics system is sort of managed and rigged. It can all be managed and rigged, as can social media. And this sounds very nihilistic and black pill, like people who out there who make good content, it's all productive and to some extent, but at the end of the line, you have to kind of think, well, if I said 80% a while ago, by the way, I was speaking loosely. It depends on the poll. It could be 80, 70, depends how the question is asked. People want less immigration into Ireland. But, you know, even if you have the lion's share of the population, but the democracy, so-called, is broken down into these parties. Like in Britain, you have Tories and Labour. Well, what if we replace, and I heard you talking about this with Morgoth, Colin. What if we replace the Tories with reform, a new lick of paint, more radical? And what if we replace Labour with something else? And, you know, and that'll keep you like spinning your wheels for another generation, let's say, right? But nothing changes, really. And what if you storm?
I don't actually think that'll work, though, for the record. That might be the idea, but if the issues persist and actually get worse, then I don't think people will just say, people won't behave as if it's still 2020, but instead of the Tories, it's reform, because it won't still be 2020. It'll be 2030, and all of the issues will be even worse than they were in 2020. So I don't think that plan will actually work, for the record.
But, okay, so if I can interrogate in reverse, if it doesn't work, then in which way does it, let's say, not work? Like, from the regime's point of view, it won't work. What does it not working look like? How does that manifest?
more upheaval like Epping and Southport, and just more awareness and protest about migrant rapes, because there'll be more migrant rapes, that sort of thing. Now, that's a problem that they might have a solution to. They might be able to deal with that just fine, for all I know. But the problem is only going to get worse for them. I don't think that changing the paintwork from Tory to Reform is going to change that.
It's kind of a retreat. It puts them back further where they have to sort of open the floodgates to more open discourse and more radical rhetoric.
Hopefully,
and then that sort of radicalizes the population more. So the baseline level of, like, 10 years ago was like, oh, you know, everything's grand. Every migrant is, we're all just getting along fine. And now the baseline is, oh, well, there are rapists coming in and we don't have houses and all of that. So the new baseline is sort of what we would have considered a huge win 10 years ago if we could have had the population with that as their baseline. And then
exactly.
If Reform don't deliver, you have this heightened sort of anger, let's say. And then you have Epping and Southport. I don't know if they're the same thing or not. They're different, aren't they? Yeah. They were different ones, yeah. But it just reminded me of Coolock. I don't know if you saw that, Colin, but Coolock in Dublin, you know, it wasn't new. We had seen City West this year was a repeat of Coolock. And City West was a big one. The eyes of the right-wing world were on it anyway. Serious stuff, right? And so in that sense, I agree with you. These things flare up more and more. But again, with City West and with all of them, the police ultimately just quell it. They come in and they just smash it up, right? And we're all angry about it. And again, it's always a Pyrrhic victory. Everything they have to crush delegitimizes them somewhat. But then on the other hand, do things just move on? Everybody gets back to trying to pay for their electricity and everything else. And we're all angry in our houses on our computers. But
yeah,
what can we kind of do, you know? My theory was always, well, if we can push back against them via the asylum issue, via, how do I put it, direct outrage, let's say, peacefully, then their response to that will sort of erode their legitimacy, and I'm not sure what happens after that. That was my take, and it turns out what happens after that in many cases is, you know, potentially nothing. But you seem to be saying that as time goes by, that increases and increases and then leads somewhere.
Well, I think what you're all talking about, what you're all sort of alluding to, is the bummer is that everyone's done all this talking and analysis and reporting and investigating, but it hasn't resulted in an infrastructure of campaigning, organizing, protesting with the funding. You know, so the NGOs, the left, are still operating, and they've always had ridiculous funding. I mean, a lot of you will remember 2015, but the migrant crisis. Droves of young, mostly women, with the refugees welcome banners, and a lot of it looked very professional, very polished and refined, and it was bizarre, really bizarre, how artificial and astroturfed it all was. And then the media singing its praises and completely from the same hymn sheet. We've got no equivalent of that on the right. And I think that it's understandable that people are frustrated that after 10 years of this or more, we don't have an equivalent of that on the right. And I would have hoped that we would have that by now. It's a very difficult issue, because what you really need is either wealthy individuals to get involved and risk a lot by funding this kind of stuff, or you need, I don't know, hedge funds, investment firms, and we know that they're all in league with BlackRock, so they're not going to do that. It's completely against their globalist interests to do that. So I don't know who would fund this. But I think unless someone does fund it, it's never going to happen.
See, the danger would be that the tension, as you're saying, increasing over time, which it definitely has. I mean, if you think of where we were in 2015, that's now 10 years ago. And in 2015, talking about immigration in this way was very taboo. It was very much, well, compared to now it was, and you know, and you know, you were genuinely breaking ground, like talking about it in that sense, because only the BNP in England had really touched on it, you know. And in Ireland, you know, there was a handful of people who had kind of said it pretty openly, but they were a handful relatively. Whereas now we live in a time where that has all kind of been integrated into the system some way, you know. Now we're not part of the system, but we're kind of being managed by the system. They're handling us. They're handling it. They're on the broader scene, like they're handling the populist stuff in a certain way. They're doing it through the Online Safety Act, whatever the thing in England is called, kind of what it's called, Harms Bill or whatever. And then there's the EU version of that. And, you know, they're fighting Twitter. They're fighting all this. Like, they've destroyed Odyssey. You know, Odyssey was a great idea. It's destroyed. And then I think, can the tension just be managed and channeled somewhere else? You see, this is the problem, you see, because I've become aware of this more recently, is that if you're angry, if there's public anger, that anger can be channeled. And you see, I've been doing this kind of series of streams about Ireland and about that era in 2013, 2014, when there was all this anger about the bank bailout and all this stuff before immigration was kind of becoming an issue at all, really, in that sense. And like, the progressives were able to channel all of that anger into their radical social agenda. And that's where you got all of the radical social change comes in. You know, they create all these NGOs. The NGOs get together, collaborate with the government, and it's just this huge, big social change. And people are actually up for it because they think this is going to solve all of the tension, get rid of the tension, you know? And so I could see that, you know, you could give someone the kind of the illusion of like, well, we know we have a Farage now and you've 10 years of that, you know? And it's like, you know what Farage is. Like, you know, there's no point in going into that. Like, and I could see something like that in Ireland too, you know? Like, I could see, like, Fianna Fáil rebranding, there's signs of it even already, and just coming out and saying, well, you know, we're going to, because it's all about IPASS, isn't it? It's all the IPASS, and that's a fraction of the immigration. Like, that's only, you know, that's another thing with the, it's another thing with this populist thing, is that it has no head. It's like a body with no head, you know? And so you have kind of donkeys basically leading them, like, and you're kind of like, where are you, like, what are you walking me around the street for? What am I doing here, really? Like, you know, like this, you're not actually interfacing with power. And you can take all that public anger when something happens, and you can kind of, with the right skill set, you actually can ball that up and throw it in the direction you want to throw it, you know? And so that's, maybe I'm negative ninny here, like, but like, I just look at that and I say they've done it before. They've been doing it since the 50s with immigration in Britain. They've been taking people who've been saying it since the 60s. You had riots, you had race riots, Nottingham and all these places, like, I can't remember half the places now.
Notting Hill, Brixton.
Notting Hill, yeah.
I can't remember them all, but yeah, yeah, loads of them.
Yeah, look at the United States. Desegregation, civil rights. I mean, the amount of strife that went back and forth there. I don't know what you think about, like, the idea of the right being our kind of topics. It's kind of coagulating here a little bit, but you know. Muslims, immigration, etc. Right, those things. These are foreign cultures, and etc. Right. The thing I envy the left for, a certain portion of the left, is their analysis of the deeper structures of society itself, socioeconomic, governmental. Whether you agree with them or not, I kind of find, like, now, how would you stop immigration if the same people who have been running things for their interests, whether that's the US State Department, whether it's chambers of commerce, whether it's multinational corporations, whether it's this, that, or the other, these things are so deeply entrenched, and their interests are so deeply entrenched, and we know what they are. They're related to deterritorialization, kind of like capitalism to an extent. I'm all for lemonade stands and all that, but you know, the modern conception of capitalism, the reality of it is completely different from a lemonade stand or a carpenter or whatever, small business owner. These systems are so sort of like globalization, global capitalism. It's like, you know, I find sometimes on the right there's a total lack of that, and it's like, how can you expect the latest Johnny-come-lately populist stooge or whatever to come along and wag their finger about immigration. But like, what's the change in that? Some rhetoric about immigration, but like, what's kind of really going on? You know, for me, I get this kind of angsty, maybe it's a teenager sort of level of angst, but it's like, I just want it all to be ripped out, torn apart and put back together in some kind of sensible way, as opposed to, no, we're globalized, we're multinational corporation, we're sort of the capitalist model. Like, not to sound like, let's say, Laurie Penny, to pick a random example. You know, if you ever look at a lottery ticket, 50 million euro, euro millions, and you think, what would I do if I won that? And you get onto your ChatGPT and you think, how much interest would I make if I put that away? You notice how wealth compounds and power compounds ultimately from that. It blows you away. You're like, what? I didn't know if you were rich, you could just accumulate power massively, right? And families do that, and corporations. You know, there are all these structures that it's like, are we really going to have the very same structure, the very same fake democracy, right? The joke of a democracy we've had for however long. And sort of think a bit of idle rhetoric about foreigners on its own is just going to switch the light after everything that's happened.
I think there's more to come out of us. I don't think, for myself personally, from the way I see it, I see a necessity that there will be a coordinated and strategized movement that will form because of necessity, because there's a vacuum on the right side, and I refrain from saying the populist term in a sense that that's completely not what I think that we are. Like as Peter said, I think Ireland will find it dreadfully hard to find a centre-right sort of alternative in the parties. But I suppose if Keith was here, Keith would probably talk on the national party front as well. That is, in our backwater, in our backyard, is a viable party institute. It's to get the rebranding of it, to give it the phoenix of the flames because of the attacks that has been put on the brand and stuff per se like that. But I think the national party, in our sense, will become the AFD for us here because of the youth that are coming through, the young men that are coming through. Like I see Stephen Redmond and Jan, loads of different counters, Keith himself and all of that. There's a real coming together now of really excellent minds as well. But then, as you say, it's the money side of it as well. You've had McGregor come out as well. These are people that can throw at it. I keep tweeting at what's his face up there? And Declan Ganley, you know, Declan Ganley had his Libertas, all right. And I throw these names out as well only because of the affluence, because of the cash flow and stuff like that. And my thinking is as you said, Garrod, that you were envious of the left in regards to they're awash with money, as the NGO class is and stuff like that. But I'd say it's money on credit. If financially things really, really take a change, which inevitably they will, or Europe is broke. Europe is trying to create euro bonds to fund and perpetuate a forever war so that they can remain in power. But eventually, he's not going to do it. Yes, one of the aces in the hole is the tariffs are going to come into play into Ireland in regards to the pharmaceutical situation. And that's going to have a major, major impact on the government spending, the corporate tax takes. 10 billion a month, I think, we're accruing 120 a year just in corporate tax takes. You know, and that's what's funding the NGOs. That's what's funding the alternative or the infiltrators, the sandbox ideas, you know, these new... We've got also the Republicans to think about. I mean, that's their back garden of sitting in infiltrators or being infiltrated. That's how that will go. But I think out of necessity, when a financial crash does come, because it's inevitable, it has to come because of the financial systems, the way that Web3 is coming online and, you know, the multipolar world now of different exchange rates and different currencies now being accepted, and the dollar now coming off its mantle now, like the printing press has been rolled off and can no longer maintain it. So all this pumping into Ukraine, all this funding cash is to disperse that cash. But out of necessity, bringing it back to an Irish context, because our UK listeners, as they say, reform. They have the different voices that are speaking out. I can't think of the name objectively, but coming back here, I think our voices will start. Eddie Hobbs is starting to speak out, but most of these people that are talking out are the Johnny Comes Latelys. I find Johnny Come Lately to the information. Even though Eddie Hobbs breaks down the scandemic, the financial implications of the the migration pact, what they're signing us up to, like stuff we've all gone through in our own podcast, broke it down to the minutia of what it would entail. But we're at that Johnny Come Lately stage with these bigger names now feeling emboldened to start speaking on those speaking points, and that a mass is bringing up. So in a matter of time and out of necessity, that political figurehead will appear, that political party. I only mentioned National Party as an alternative, but that cohesive sort of managed political thing that we need. Like, I'm personally of a dictatorship is required here. I mean, to effectively get the things that we need, there's going to be a nationalist dictatorship is what's required, because to reset, the system needs resetting. The operating system needs to be taken out, and a new nationalist operating system needs to be put in place, which will be fair in broad strokes, but it will be the returning, the removal of the discrimination against the Irish populace, and the reframing of them as priority citizens, and then everything else can follow downhill after that. I was speaking on it earlier on today. First-class citizens, second-class citizens, discriminatory. I mentioned it or described it as positive discrimination, because we've had, since 1975, since our ascension into the European Union, we have been taken advantage of. Our fishing rights now being decimated again. Our fishing quotas being reduced now to feed the massive population growth in the main European body there, to feed their growing populations, taken out of our back pockets. Now the farmers being imposed, and they've seen what happens to the UK, to the UK farmers with the inheritance tax. Now they've seen that it's being driven back by the farmers, you know, eventually getting off and going out and doing what the French do naturally. Our Irish farmers are kind of, we'll sit back and see what happens when the other side comes out. Maybe they'll make all the big decisions. But we need that mobilization of the farmers, the fishermen again, to come through with small mama and papa businesses as well, to get the people that they want. The Paul Trevelyans, those talking voices that are now that are acceptable to the major population, do make rational conversation points. Don't seem as unhinged as we might come across, or off the track as we might come across. But these are the acceptable.
Not that bad.
We need to focus on them. We need to focus on them. We need to encourage them and embolden them to bring us further away from the centre position and over to the right side of position in regards to re-immigration, denaturalisation of passports, a reset of criteria of border controls, strategies going forward for business. What are we going to do as an economy without the corporate tax take care? Are we going to self-fund? Can we revitalise the fishing fleet? Can we get farmers a better an incentive if they refuse the Mercosur deal? We have a whole tranche of intellectual minds. Once they are given that platform, once we get on that platform, but we have to beat the enemy, which is unlimited fucking free credits. Excuse my French. Because when the funds are drained from them, we can't drain the funds, and we can't get funds so that we could have bigger shows, that we could come out with these talking points. So it's going to be business dependent. The migration pact and the pandemic, they're all heavily needed businesses to get involved and see that there was a potential profit in what the globalists were leading them down the path to go into. Now we'll have to say, okay, understand them, that in a deflationary period, there's also profits to be made on the way down in the cycle for a period of time if you're smart enough. But all of that free credit has to be withdrawn from the system so that the oxygen is cut off to the NGOs, that the oxygen is cut off to government spending, and things will fall in place. That's the way I like to see it. And it's decades in the making. We just have to keep playing our part. Back to you guys.
Yeah, I would say, actually, in fairness to the NP aren't really populist. I would say the NP, to me, are the foundational kind of...
I never described them as populist. Yeah. There's two
different groups, though. Like, I mean, the NP, to me, are separate from this kind of populist thing. You know, I know they attend the protests and everything, of course, too, and they organize a lot of stuff. But, like, they have their own thing. Like, the NP are their own thing. They're very clearly an Irish party, whereas a lot of this kind of populist stuff is a bit astroturfed, in my opinion, some of it, you know, it seems very, you know, artificial or whatever. And I'm sure they're
well. Ezra Levant.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he's been sticking his nose all over the place, yeah, like so to speak, you know.
Well, yeah. I just mentioned him because he was, you know, I it wasn't pretty, and I think he got beaten, he got punched or something, but he just showed up like he always does, and you think, what's Ezra Levant doing in Ireland? That's so strange. And am I getting mixed up? Did that happen?
You're not.
Was that this year?
No,
that happened. Like, yeah. I've got a whole spiel on that. I haven't done a whole lot of live streaming this year, but one of the few things I felt inspired to, like, go off on throughout this year was this unhinged conspiracy theory I had that the Zionist Atlanticist, somewhat Anglo, and by for all the English listeners or British, I don't mean Anglo like average people, the Anglo sort of Atlanticist political structure, that whole entity, you know, which goes back centuries, however long, right? That kind of, there is a nexus between the Anglo-American, the Zionist thing. It's basically the hegemonic power that we live under, whether we're Irish, English, Estonian, doesn't matter. And that's one of those big heuristics for me, again, with all the talk about Muslims, and it's, of course, it's legit to criticize Islamization. But the question comes back to hegemony. If we're to analyze it, stepping it back from populism and Twitter and Matrix and all of that, which hegemon do we live under? I don't live under Rialtas na hÉireann or the Irish government. Not really, right? They're not some power base. Same way a Chinese person lives under the CCP and Xi Jinping, Confucian, you know, power. What do I actually live under? It's not Ireland. It's that Anglo Atlanticist American Washington based and very Jewish Zionist influenced, as we all know, all that stuff. We kind of live under that. Looking at the right wing stuff, you know, I found myself observing certain details. There's like a cat giving out to me here in the other room. Sorry. But as you do, yeah. I know, it's just I'll have to put in the second earphone and just drown it out. Yeah, she's at me again. But, you know, there were certain things that were happening that in each individual case, when it started, I said, this is a Zionist infiltration. We'll just call the whole thing Zionist, Washington, London, Zionist, whatever. This is Zionist infiltration of our movement. I can sense it. And people kind of said, I think you're reading too much into a minor issue. And I said, yeah, it's hard for me to explain. I know I sound more crazy as I try to elaborate, but bear with me. And everyone was, not everyone, but a lot of people were so swept up in the populist moment that I kind of did feel a bit crazy to start with, but I went with my gut. And then as time went on over the year, more and more things started to happen, and I gradually felt more and more vindicated. You know, I was like, the guy with a cork board and strings and a Pepe Silva or whatever it's called, the unhinged conspiracy theorist. It started with a big flag on a rock in Wexford or Waterford, somewhere like that. And it was a Palestinian flag that's been there a long time. And it was painted over by our country, A-R-E country, right? Our country, we're taking back our country from the Muslim jihad, whatever. And I said, I don't know about this, lads. This just seems like I'm seeing it celebrated by Ezra Levant and so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And they all said, the Irish are standing up. And I said, oh, we're standing up, are we? Interesting. Standing up with this flag, because this is our country, green, white, and orange. This is Ireland era, Abu. Brilliant. So we're real patriots here. But can we look at the flag that's being painted over, and can we look at the vested interests and the huge hegemonic structure, bigger than any Irish government, that has a key interest in our country as a regime change agent or a signal jammer for pervasive anti-Zionist sentiment in Ireland? And who would be a better interrupter of that among the left and the mainstream than an ascendant populist group with a legitimate grievance, immigration? And if we could just shoehorn this flag, Palestine versus Ireland, Muslims versus the Western Crusaders, if we could shoehorn that in, that would be perfect.
Just wait until you get your own Paddy Robinson.
That's what I'm saying.
Entire purpose is to make sure that doesn't happen.
So we have a motive, we have means, we have precedent, we have a perfect vehicle. It all comes together. Again, this is the crazy conspiracy theorist coming out. I'm saying it all fits, but it does all totally fit. And my argument was that if the Zionist lobby who run Washington, which effectively runs Ireland more than Brussels or anything else, if they're not doing this, if they're not using us like this, like I describe, then they're idiots. because it's too perfect. It's so perfect. How would they miss this? Unless they were stupid. They were not savvy political operators. No, they're not known for being unsavvy political operators.
And just to buttress what you're saying there, I mean, just related to banking, but just like, it's demonstrably provable that historically, like, US money has flowed into Ireland since the 60s, like, you know, in a radical way. You had the ESRI in Dublin. That's funded by the Ford Foundation. That's how that got started. Do you know? So our whole paradigm, the reason there's anything here is because they allow that to be here. So just to say, like, you're totally on the ball, like, with saying that. You know what I mean?
MNCs, like, you know, they clearly run the country. Everybody knows the pharma, the everything else. And the way when American diplomats and MNC leaders come to country, to come to Ireland, the way they roll out the red carpet and they phone, they don't really do that for European bureaucrats. And then, so that's the theory set up. And you go, okay, is it a crazy theory or whatever? And then you go, okay, so right now I'm just talking about a flag. Maybe it's just a flag. But then as time went by, Levant came to the Cork protest. Now, the Cork protest might have been legit against immigration, etc. Patriots rise up. I'm sure most people there were legitimately there expressing their grievance. That's wonderful. And I don't know who organized it or what their motive was, but it came together. It was 90% legitimate grievance, but to what end is it going for? Levant came to Cork. Why does a guy from Canada just fly to Cork for a relatively speaking rinky-dink little, you know, protest, a few thousand people waving flags? What's his big interest, right? He arrives and he starts spinning the narrative. He says that the Palestine people were the same as Antifa, even though when you studied it, those were two separate, largely separate protests, actually two different groups. He said that the one day the Irish patriots came to, and maybe I'm laboring the details here, but the one day that Irish patriots came together at 1 o'clock on Saturday evening on Grand Parade in Cork City, the one day, of course, these Palestine jihadis come along to spoil the fun. But then when you took a closer look at the situation, you realize that every week for the past year, the Palestinian stop the genocide, whatever thing, had been going to that location at that time on that day every week ritualistically for the last year. So the reality was, they don't own the public space, but the reality was that they go there every week to that space. And then this other protest got put together. We don't quite know, you know, it's not to point fingers, but it came together. And so it was kind of the opposite of what Ezra was saying, isn't it? If you were to say anything. And he said that the Echo or the Irish Examiner spun the truth and called the Patriots a bunch of far right or whatever. And that was applying incendiary labeling to a group that was actually not that big a deal, not that radical. But he was calling the Palestinian protest, which was called like ceasefire now, he was saying that they were the pro-Hamas demonstration. And I looked at the signs, and again, I don't lose sleep about the pro-Palestine people. That's not my thing. But just as a factual observer, I'm looking at it going, well, no, I've seen the entire Palestine march. I've looked up the organizing groups and their rhetoric. I can't see anything about pro-Hamas. I can see ceasefire now. So Ezra Levant, doing the whole big lie, the switcheroo on everything, is saying that, okay, so you're labeling the Patriot movement a far-right extremist group, but he's actually doing, at the same time, he's doing a switcheroo on it all, on who showed up to whose regular protest, who is called what. He's running the whole game, and he's saying he's coming to Ireland to document what's going on. I want to see what these Patriots are doing, standing up against immigration, and it's like, Ezra, you don't need to waste the flight. We don't like immigration. We want it to stop. It's too much. It's increasing the price of housing. It's alienating us. It's dangerous. There are young girls being attacked, groomed, whatever. Same as Australia, same as UK, same as Canada. You don't need to go on a big, expensive fact-finding tour to Cork with a camera and a microphone to necessarily find that out. Why are you really here? And then we have these people who, I don't know what their motives are, but they're waving Israel flags the same day. And people say, no, that guy just has a flag. Don't be crazy. And I go, okay, well, I don't know the guy. I'm not a mind reader. And I'll just finish, right? But people go, okay, he was waving it to piss off the lefties because the lefties are so annoying. They're so woke. He's just doing the opposite. And I went, oh, okay. So I was crazy on painting over the flag on the mountain. I'm crazy about Ezra Levant. I'm crazy about the guy with the Zionist is literal Israel flag. Yeah, maybe I'm just crazy. I'm not a mind reader. Raheem might be a fine guy. But then, like, the next week, the same guy posts on Instagram, he's going up a building, scaling a building in a very hard-to-reach spot, finding a sign that says Zionist ambassador out. It's obviously lefty, anti-Zionist graffiti, plain and simple. He goes up on a ladder and paints it over with an Irish flag, right? Now, that wasn't him replacing a foreign Palestinian flag with an Irish flag. He was replacing a very specific piece of political rhetoric. The same guy who was waving a Zionist flag in Cork the previous week, just because he's annoying the lefties, and Ezra is just there because he's on a fact-finding journalistic mission. And the protest came together just because that location, that time, and it was actually the lefties interfering, etc., etc. And I'll just finish, Colin. As in, like, I know I'm going on, but it went on and on like that. And I found a certain portion of the right would go, oh, I see where you're coming from. It's like, I mean, I might have doubted you on day one, but I mean, it's undeniable. And they're already schooled up on the Zionist stuff and all that. But there's a whole portion of people who could not fathom these obvious signs, no matter what way you described it to them.
This populist brain.
You see, I would, but don't you think that the sheer obviousness and clumsiness of this stuff is... it's hilarious and kind of encouraging, because I do. I mean, like, that what you just described there, I nearly burst out laughing when he scaled a wall in order to rub out this anti-Zionist whatever mural. It's hilarious. It's cartoonish. I mean, I'm not going to put up memes on screen about this, but it does remind me of some memes, like Ben Shapiro in this Star of David superhero outfit kind of stuff. It's ridiculous. And that's the kind of thing that I take heart from over the last year or two, is that their messaging has become really amateurish and ham-fisted. Mm. Ham might not be appropriate in this context. You know what I mean? Anyway, it's just become very clumsy. And it used to be much, much more sleek and clever and subtle and cool, even. If you think about, again, Hollywood films in the 90s, that sort of stuff. So I think it's a good sign that they're doing this kind of thing, because I think it's a sign that they're losing their finesse. And maybe that's out of panic. Maybe it's just generational rot over time. I don't know. The competence crisis within that group, but or just desperation. But whatever it is, they're not as good at what they do as they used to be. Mm-hmm. And that's personified by Jonathan Greenblatt being the head of the ADL, and he's nowhere near as competent as Abe Foxman in 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
It's a much harder sell.
I like this.
You know, it is a much harder. Yeah. Like, I mean, to do this in Ireland would be like that. You would be like Edward Bernays, like, to pull this off, to market Israel in Ireland. It's just like, which is why I find it very odd that the conservative movement in Ireland, the official kind of conservative movement, insists on attaching itself to this. Like, why not just even take a neutral stance, you know, rather than kind of, you know, I just find the whole setup odd. Like, you know?
But especially with Ireland, it's about just one last thing, especially with Ireland, because obviously it's got this history of being colonized and brutalized. And so I could understand, I'm not saying this is the case, but I could very much understand Irish people sympathizing with the Palestinians. And so to instead sort of force a commonality between the Irish and the Israelis just seems ridiculous.
It's a very hard needle to thread. I'm putting myself in the mind of Ezra Levant, because they study it, and they don't have to entirely know the context in Ireland. They have a few lackeys around the place who will tell them the nitty gritty of the local minor political politics or politics. You know, and they'll come up with a plan. And it wasn't so much to come out. They knew, unlike with Tommy and with Christian evangelists in America, they knew a hardcore pro-Zionist message wasn't going to sell ever. So what we could do is tuck it away as, It's not pro-Zionist right. It's anti-pro-Palestinian. Pro-Palestinian being the dominant, something like 80% of people in Ireland, to some extent or another, sympathise with the Palestinian cause much more than they do any Zionist. So that's, and that's not just lefty activists, that's just kind of like across the board. So you can't float a ardent pro-Zionist message. You can float an anti-woke, anti-lefty, anti-immigration, anti-pro-Palestinian. Just kind of tuck it in there a little bit. Start daubing, this, create a flag war. There's the Irish flag of the Patriots, and there is the Palestinian flag of the lefties, of Paul Murphy and the NGOs.
So it's not a pro-Zionist thing. It's an anti-Zionist thing. I mean, that's, I don't know, that just seems desperate in terms of public religion.
Anti-pro-Palestinian, because the idea was that they're all out there with their Palestinian flags. And again, the devil of it is that it's based on a truism. It is frustrating. I personally sympathize with Palestine, but the idea that all these NGO lefties are waving Palestine flags exclusively, it's sort of outgroup. It's like there's a huge truth in it, for sure. And that's the beauty of it. There's a lot of truth to it. They're the same people, the same activists pushing immigration and all of that. So it's perfect. We just slip it in there. Not too pro-Zionist, but just anti-pro-Palestinian. And anti-woke and anti-immigration, all of that, and just play it out like that. And I know it sounds crazy conspiratorial, but again, you just look over to Tommy Robinson, you look at...
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah,
and they have to brand it for an Irish... you know, they have to kind of take a step back for Ireland, pitch it a different way. Kind of entryism, you could call it. And I was just saying, look, that's how it is. And at the end of the day, I don't mind if... Personally, a flag here, a flag there, a narrative here, a narrative there is not that big a deal. It's the fact that it's taking such an influence over... Our thing was, we're against asylum centres, we're against immigration, and we'll do anything we can to advance that message. We don't want to bog that down in being the anti-Palestinian people. That's not our issue. So let's just skip over it and let's just do our thing and not be Zionist stooges. And it felt like a lot of people weren't kind of seeing that. And a lot of it comes back to Washington as well. One bigger point is that being an American stooge is similar. You know, like pro-Trump. I saw Mike Cernovich, to bring it over to Britain, right? Mike Cernovich recently tweeted that with the rise of Muslims in the UK, they could get a hold of the nuclear codes, which they would then give to Iran. Therefore, a regime change, an American-led regime change, is justified in Britain. And I'm sure our patriots in England would rally to our side. Now, nobody likes the government of Britain. It's lefty, it's this, it's that. Muslims are coming in. But come on. You know what I mean? Like, you look at stuff like that. He didn't mention Zionists necessarily there, but he mentioned Iran. He mentioned effectively regime change out in the open. And it's dressed up in immigration, Muslims. It's like, I just want no part of anything vaguely like that. You know, that's my big problem this year, I think.
Yeah, you don't want America to install democracy in Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, it's been here for a dog's age. It's been here, like we were talking about funny money going into Irish politics and all that, Bertie Ahern and his party, his government at the time sanctioning 200 million from Irish aid into one of the bigger charity foundations that was kind of like Ireland's pay-in, Ireland's the state paying into, Micheál Martin giving out 124 million willy-nilly. I'd love to know the process that the tarnish that can just take that whatever pot or whatever funding. There's no way that we can see, well, where did you derive that money, that you take it from somewhere else, you deprive one something else and give it to Ukraine. There's no accounting for any of that kind of money. It just seems to have this petty cash little tin that they both have. They can dip into the exchequer and just throw 125 that way, and it's morally, it's the right thing to do. It's, aren't we there? Aren't we so good? Always trying to achieve the moral high ground and everything and anything. And playing back to the earlier talking points at the start, in an Irish government context, it's so superficial, so transparent now that we can see through everything that they're trying to do, that they're not even convincing their own VT prostitutes. Even the VT prostitutes are pushing back on some of the questioning, I think, because it just doesn't make sense. I'm trying to think of that particular situation where Neil Martin was confronted by a number of journalists only recently in the last couple of weeks, and you could see him visibly getting agitated because he was professing about that we must stand in solidarity with the Ukraine and it's about their sovereignty. And the journalists weren't questioning the sovereignty of the borders, but they were questioning on a financial aspect. How can you take 4,000 from OAPs here in Ireland and take away the blister packs? You know, this was a minute amount, but it would have carried the OAP, the elderly population, through the winter period of time and given them comfort, because the blister pack, you're bedridden all the day, loads of different things going on. This simple little thing to ease it, quite callously just taken away. But then the benevolence of 124, that's going to do nothing. That's gone in 2 days. It's gone if it even made it off Zelensky's plane. We understand that now, but they're all playing catch up on all of this corruption and it's all being played out. My original... sorry, go ahead.
No, so to add to that, I was going to say, you're correct, like, in saying it's been here a long time. Do you know, that is absolutely for sure. And, like, this gets back to this thing of why can't people kind of see this? We're looking at it saying, we need to be careful with this now. And a lot of it is because a lot of the well-meaning people that get caught up in kind of populist movements and everything, you know, they often haven't got that. Like Garrod was saying earlier, he admired the kind of left-wing kind of thing where they have this, like, structural analysis, basically. They have a theory of history. They have a theory of social change. They have a theory of economics. And you may not like all of it. I certainly don't. But it's actually important to understand how they do that. And you can like build off of that by reading what they do. You can actually construct your own theory of history, your own analysis. And so you don't fall in for these kinds of deceptive traps or whatever, you know, like the idea that we're going to link our nationalist movement to this insane at this particular moment in history to actually decide, actually, we like what Israel is doing right now. I mean, Israel is doing the worst thing ever, right? It's doing worse than it's ever done right now, you know? So this is the worst possible time you could possibly link up with this, like, and link this to cover yourself in this shit, like, and say, yes, this is what we are, you know? So, no. But this is the thing, is that this is the populist thing, which I separate from nationalism. Nationalism is its own concept. Populism is a body without a head, you know? Populism is, I feel, I want to get out on the street. I want to fucking, you know, react. I want to vent. And the problem is the populist assumptions are basically liberal. So this is the problem with the because they actually take seriously all this civil rights stuff and we have the human right to do this. And it's like, no, the truth is human rights is just what some progressive in the 40s said who had power in America and said, we're going to construct the UN charter and we declare this. And they've built all of this edifice on top of all of that. And the problem with the populists is that they actually accept it on face value. And they don't say, well, actually, this is just a power structure that I'm looking at. And, you know, basically, when it comes down to it, we have no human rights, you know, like you'd just be called far right. But that's a way of dehumanizing you. That's a way of taking away your rights, you know, saying you can be delegitimized. You can have your job taken away. You can have you debanked. You can, you know, and people have gone through this. Huge amounts of people go to prison, get railroaded into prison, you know. And so that's the problem with populism, is that it's got this belief, this faith, has more faith in liberal democracy and populism than there is in any left-winger. You know, the left-winger will kind of say, well, I'm going to use this. I'm going to use this for what we want, you know, our minority groups, our people. Whereas the populist thing is like, we want to protest like they did in the 60s, but the people in the 60s had the power of the federal government in America behind them. There's no comparison to saying your protest is going to be taken the same way that the protest in the 60s was taken, or one of these race riots in Britain or whatever, you know? So that's the fundamental problem.
Yeah, you're reminding me of a quote about January the 6th, written by Kant Bot at the time. And I've read this out before, but I'll read it out again because it remains so relevant. And here it is. So this is Kant Bot talking about the so-called insurrection in America. Imagine storming the capital of the United States as the government of the country literally flees, and then just wandering around the building, confused about why the level isn't ending. Instead of declaring a new government and issuing warrants for congressman's arrest. And it's this idea of, I mean, I think the four of us are roughly of a similar generation, and I think we can remember this from video games back in the day, where you would get to the thing, and and that's it. You've
you're teleported up to the next level, and it's all different.
Exactly.
Next thing, you know, I've won.
Exactly. You've won the achievement. You've done the thing because you got to the place, or you found the piece of treasure, or whatever it is. So they got inside the capital, and they thought, okay, that's it. Now we're here now, so we must logically have achieved power. But it doesn't actually work like that. Power is not really physical, and it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you're on the street or if you're in the capital. You don't have power. And I think what Peter was saying there is similar, where people have this democratic notion that, well, if we protest, if we complain, and we tell the truth and it rings true with people, then everyone will know that we're telling the truth, and then we'll get our way. And it doesn't work like that at all. I mean, as we all know, we've been talking about this stuff for 10 years, and those in power don't actually, they're not actually scared of the truth. So you can say the truth and it just washes off them. It's irrelevant. It's meaningless. It doesn't matter that you're speaking the truth.
Just to finish on that point, though, but I think we will eventually all come around to the same conclusion that it will be the force doctrine that will ultimately will have to be applied. I.e., you understand the force doctrine as well. It's the movement. It's the perpetration of violence, the ultimate arbitrator of violence, or the threat of violence as well. And then again, in a nationalist sense, to dovetail your point as well, steer away from the populist rhetoric and stick it to the national populist. And that's why I go straight for the high point of a soft dictatorship or a dictatorship or an emergency board that will just have blanket powers to effectively do the things that we change. But the force doctrine was, we'll have to convince enough people that it's true, our numbers, if we're going to keep it in a peaceful, non-compliant sort of way. But that's what we had in the 80s, was the force doctrine, is that we applied force. I'm talking about what happened between Ireland and the UK, is that certain measures were taken and it applies the force doctrine. If you don't do this, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And I think we're going to come back to that point, hopefully a little bit more methodical in thought and a little bit more directed, rather than random violence and random thing, but a more effective, cohesive threat of force. And I use that in the metaphorical.
Yeah, you're obviously not advocating violence. What you're saying is, as Peter said earlier, the populist movement is a body without a head. It's reacting. It's instinctive. What we're seeing here is the force of the organized, the success of the organized minority against the disorganized majority. And I think
that's the rule. They will always be an organized minority will defeat any mass of people that are not thinking. And that's the problem. And it's like, I did a tweet the other day, like, I was basically said, human rights lawyers have had more impact on our society. Basically, I don't know what I said exactly, but basically what I was getting at is they've had more impact on all immigration policy. How this is all, it all comes out of universities. Certain ideas are popular. This is what they did with the queer theory. It was all the same thing. It came out of the universities in the 80s. It was put into legislation after 10 years, basically, because they're the ones constructing the canon of liberal theology, basically, which is the law. It's just theology, you know, like the law is just descended from theological ideas that are much older, and that's why it has the meaning. We look at the law and we say it just has significance, but when you start looking at the law as this is just something constructed by someone with power, and so you start to realize, okay, I look at it as a kind of theological thing, it's ethical and all the rest of it, and gobshite us, we think we're going to do the right thing, but these guys don't care about that, and they ultimately are putting what they want in the law. And so it's the Schmitt thing, like, he who has the power is sovereign. He who decides on how the law is applied, that's who has sovereignty. And so we live in a tyranny of legalism, of lawyers. You know, if you go back to Obama, in the Obama era, he was a lawyer. Okay, he came out of Chicago, and his people who were training Obama were basically people who had been terrorists in the 60s. Bill Ayers.
It's astonishing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Sorry, go on. And also, I'll just say Tony Blair was also a lawyer, for the record. But yeah.
And Blairism.
He was Fabian. And they're all very well educated and strung together.
Yeah. And Blairism is what we're living in, like, really, when you think about it. We're living in the Blair, like, those think tanks, like Demos and all of that. That stuff has fanned out with its way of thinking, like that has, and it's infiltrated every institution through common purpose and all this stuff. This is what's, this is the actual government effectively. And it's like a decentralized, what would you call it? Like it's a network, but it's kind of informal. It becomes formal at a certain point, and then you look into, oh, they had a conference here, and this think tank was here, and Blair spoke, and Blair's advisor was here, and you're like, is this a formal organization or structure? And so, like, the kind of the streams I'm doing at the moment, just to plug them, but basically, it's about this thing called the Open Government Partnership. And what this basically is how American soft power influenced the rest of the world, including Britain as well, part of it, after the crash. And basically, they have got into partnership with civil society. So all the NGOs are in a process of co-creation. And these ideas all percolated out of Britain and America in the 90s and 2000s, brought into the government, externalized all over the world, basically. And that's how you're, that's what's the kind of structures that are in place. You know, no one's probably heard of that structure, but it exists. It creates national plans and it constructs law, gets stuff on the books, gets stuff, you know, before it's ever suggested to people, it's in a national action plan. And that's how you're governed. You're governed through this decentralized kind of, and it's a certain type of person. It's like this, like the idea of the ultimate middle class manager, you know, and it's like that class of person, you see it emerge in the 17th century, I believe, during the time of Francis Bacon and everything. These are the proto-technocrats, you know, and you see them throughout history developing these grand plans for society. And that's, you see it in France with Comte and Saint-Simonians and all these guys. They have big plans for how they're going to structure. It's all about social transformation. So Blairism is radical because it's all about change. It's actually a kind of an evolutionary way of looking at life, you know. And so there's a whole kind of spiritual way of looking at the world in Blairism, in a really fucked up way. It is like
Satanism. That's about the only spiritual aspect that I'd be, is a Satanist aspect of it as well. That'd be it.
Well, you could link the thing we're lacking as well, in a way, is a social fabric or a higher principle that you see in, to take the opposite of that structure, you know, Iran and China and these other countries that seem to be outside of that thing, right? And they're not perfect countries, but, you know, somewhere like Iran has its own history of, you know, when you look into it, it's kind of fascinating. They have this whole other social order, largely through the Shia Islam and all of that, that they don't just look at business. They don't just look at, like, this open society stuff. They have a higher kind of ethic of their own sort of thing. And then China has this deep history of 4,000 years of ups and downs and stability. And, you know, you'll see Lee Kuan Yew and Xi Jinping, whatever his name. Am I saying that right? Xi Jinping. No. What's his name? Deng Xiaoping, I think. Anyway, these names get confusing, don't they? But the Chinese ethic of stability over time and basically ethnocentrism that they have, etc., has kind of guided them through this a little bit. Whereas, you know, what do we have anymore? Maybe it's back to the cyclical view of history and a civilization in decline or something, but it's like there's nothing to stand up to the Karl Popper business, you know, monstrosity, whatever that is. Like all of that stuff you're talking about, Peter, it's like,
the open,
you know, it's coming into a vacuum. Now, you could say the Christianity and the ethnocentrism was destroyed to create that vacuum. But it's like, you know, it's hard to build a nationalism or a pushback without one, good theory, like the left have structural theory, and two, without some sort of ethic beyond individualism, survival, earthly survival kind of type of thing, pursuit of truth, virtue, you know, that other places seem to have. The connection between family, you know, in China, the family and all of this is very important because, and the wider family and community, because they don't trust that the state will always be there. I just wonder about all of that. Are we very much, as individuals in the West, just kind of floating along completely rudderless with this monstrosity that has a whole network like you describe and is totally locked in? And then all of us, we're just kind of scrambling around the place, you know, a little bit. But there's nothing to attach ourselves really to, in a way. And here we are then on the internet.
Well, what you're describing is kind of like Enlightenment thought is kind of has been brought to its conclusion, you know? And so we had to have this assumed liberalism. And so we think that the whole thing about every political system has to be liberal. The whole world has to become liberal. This is how our elites think, basically. The whole world has to become an open society and liberal and be integrated. And this is a very different way of thinking that other cultures, like you're describing, don't have this. Like our focus is always outward. The West was all about going outward, going to colonies, going to South America, going to America, going to the New World, creating kind of like planned communities, ideal communities and all. You don't see this. Like anthropology emerged in the West. It didn't emerge in China, you know. So this our problem is that we cannot look inward in the West. We cannot simply say we're actually have to pull up the wall here for a while. It's almost like it's against our religion. It's against liberalism. It's against the Enlightenment.
It's against the current orthodoxy because it's ring fenced and it's perpetuated, and we are bombarded with the liberalism in all aspects. But if that external force of global or financial crush comes out and they're not able to fund it and keep it going, and when the oxygen is taken out of it, then it will be a level playing field again, and our ideas will win through. They're, of course, because we're logically consistent in most things. You know, we don't jump in for the critical theories, the queer theory, and like. Just to jump back on that aspect of legalese, the use of legalese and the way they're defining laws. We got the Ibram Joseph now, who's lauded into that position of professorship, who can't mumble words coherently, but was given a professorship, who's elevated through DEI and is now instructing us on our white privilege and is pushing it through. Like it's going into the curriculum now as we see it. But she's also talking about the censorship aspect of it as well, because they do still control the social media platforms. All the HQs are here. Commissioner De Hare now is in bed in sock with them, and Ireland is pivotal to shut that social media space. And I'm just kind of steering it back. I'm bringing it back here because today, though, Ireland, Harris is talking about the ID verified social media for the under 16s. They're gonna remove the under 16s entry into on social media for our safety. So it's the push tying in with the whole aspect of no matter what we do and what narratives we bring up or talking points we bring up, the strategy still carries ahead. The push for digital IDs still carries on. Here we have now back bringing it back to an Irish context and into an Irish conversation again as much as we expose them and we annihilate the narrative less than a 24-hour period in any given time, hence the scrambling. This is the double down aspect of it now, is they're going to push forward for the digital ID, and they're going to run in tandem with the UK's push for digital ID as well. We've already got a soft form of it. Well, if you're self-employed, we've got the digital wallet. When you operate through revenue as a company and stuff like that, we all have to, all our revenue stuff is already in the digital wallet for revenue. That's going to come in line where they bring all the, you know, financial bits and pieces back in together. But what I'm saying is the liberal theology is the double down, and it's the face of Marxism represented as liberalism, but it's completely socialism. And, you know, going back to the economic theory of Marxism and stuff like, not even using all of that, but what I'm saying is they are effectively doubling down, and they will double down till they expel their energy. And that's what we've got to kind of ride the storms out as well and keep pushing back as well. Do you not think?
We have to do the work in our own sense that has been done on the left and for the liberals. Like they have their own way of looking at the world, their own theory of history, their own theory of everything. We have to construct that, and without that, everything you build is basically just slogans and simple like demands. I want this, I want that. You have to actually, like, there has to be, you know, really deep thought about where we're going as a civilization. Like I think we have to be thinking civilizationally first and foremost. We have to draw from the roots.
Prevent civilizational erasure. That's the big buzzword coming out since the American strategy doctrine came out there as well. We have to prevent our own civilizational erasure here in Ireland by being forthright and forceful to push our talking points into the zeitgeist as well, and manifest the ideas of denaturalization and mass, you know, cutting off the welfare so to incentivize self-deportation, all that kind of stuff, and manage it that way.
I think something that you should all bear in mind is that the left have this whole infrastructure of thought. You know, they've got the practical infrastructure as well, but they've got this huge body of thought that they've developed over a century or more than that. But the important thing is that it's all artificial. I mean, they've needed to do that because it's so unnatural. They've needed to do that because it's so counterintuitive and because it's so frankly nonsensical. And this is why, you know, the SJW of 10 years ago now looks like a ridiculous figure, because it's all mumbo jumbo. And so when Peter, when you say that that we in the West are not good at looking inward, I agree to an extent, but I also think 100 years ago, we wouldn't have accepted what we're putting up with now. 100 years ago, we would have just rejected all of this outright and violently. So to an extent, I think the job is actually much easier for us than the job for the left was 100 years ago, because we are in sync with human nature. We are not trying to manufacture something completely absurd and crazy and counterintuitive and suicidal. The main credo here is the survival of our group. And I think that is something that any sane person, free of pretensions, would go along with. It's so common sense, it shouldn't even need to be said. So I think that we should draw hope from that our job, and at least intellectually, is actually extremely straightforward.
Yeah, I agree. It is a straightforward process, and it has to, and it is. It's hard in the sense that there is work to be done, but at the same time, that work is not an artificial construct, like you're saying. What they have done is they've used language to construct all kinds of like phony realities, basically. So people buy into these phony identities, you know, and they're all surrogates for your kind of authentic identity, which is inherently naturalistic. It's going to be connected to your family. I know there's a wide, you know, like the our kind of view of the world is very actually holistic and natural, because it starts off with your own family. There's your community. There's your nation. And your nation is just a family anyway, because you're related to people all over it, you know. So the idea that you're supposed to care more about a guy from Somalia than your own community is insane. And the only people who would think that are insane, I would say. I'd say they're functionally insane. You're doing something, especially with these other societies, because they are so community focused. Like I saw there was some guy filmed a documentary about Minnesota, and there's like all these Somalians, and they're kind of running these corrupt kind of rackets and everything. And you know, I was looking at it going like, this guy is a well-meaning guy. He's just investigating it, and he can't fathom how these guys actually view the world at all. It's so alien to think like that. He believes in the American ideal, you know. And he's an honorable person.
I don't blame
person.
Anybody. If you want to come here and work and make a better life for yourself, I'm all for it. I'm not racist. That you can come here and do that. They don't understand. They're coming here to assault your welfare system and fund themselves back home to destroy it, hollow it out even.
And they have these ethnic like relationships that are so strong that we can't think of, like, Jesus, imagine your extended family operating like a gang, you know. And that for us, that's just so outlandish to think about, you know.
Imagine being able to trust and rely on other Irish people, other white Scottish people, other white people just by default. You know that Irish guy is going to help you against the foreigners. He's not going to betray you. That's the level of solidarity that they have, I think. So that's why it's rare to see a Muslim speaking out against the Pakistani grooming gangs, for example. Very rare.
And the political capital of it, because they will vote as a family group, as an ethnic group, and they can sell that. That's what the Minnesota thing provides as well, is that they will vote, they will cohesively work as a voter bloc. And you can see that in the UK. And it'll come into play more and more here as the numbers grow. And that's what Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and all our Irish things bank on, is that the imams will tell them which way to go, the figureheads, and they will just because of dogma, follow along blindly, because they will be the beneficiaries of it for a time.
But the fish, you know, the fish rots from the head, because it's something you said a while ago, Rowan, that because we're kind of getting into a black building, and you say, if all this pressure wasn't there, something to the effect of this, if the pressure wasn't there, if the indoctrination and the power wasn't there, we wouldn't just be in civilizational decline with no sense of ourselves and all that. Actually, it's right there bubbling under the surface. Look at City West. Look at Listunvarna. You know, our human nature is actually still fully intact. Just because we're white or Western doesn't mean we've gone crazy. The force comes from so-and-so is going to get sacked strategically. You show up at City West and you mount a resistance, and you get crushed, right? They just bring overwhelming force. And they've had to do that multiple times, which in Ireland, that's why I think Ireland stands out, because I say we, of course, I don't, you know, I was sitting at home, but as a people brought the fight to the system and the state, one man to man, effectively. And they put and they got their, you know, men in silly uniforms, the guards, to come along. Their little, you know, like the Indians who in China, in Hong Kong back in the day, who the British colonial regime used to dress up Indians and get them to bully the Chinese in Hong Kong. It's just like that, a colonial police force, effectively, to, you know, and their wages depend on it. They came along and beat everyone up and kind of quelled the protest. And it really does just hang on all of that. The ability to hire and fire, the ability to incentivize NGO people, give them a little wage to live, and the ability to beat people up when push comes to shove, in these places like Coolock and City West. But it's a very thin line. It really is. I agree with you that it's not all like hopelessness, that their power hangs, because it is so unnatural, it hangs on a very thin thread. And it and the legitimization weakens all the time. The social fabric is dying off. The economic prosperity is going for most people. You have Russia and all of these external forces. Like we do, we are in, compared to these lefties trying to sell, you know, crazy stuff 60 years ago, we actually, you know, it's like the world is our oyster in a sense politically, because it's just that very thin film holding it together for them. And yet that's where it ultimately comes from, is that that very top, you know, it's not the Irish government. It's not some NGO lefty. They're being paid by someone who's being paid by someone. And like Peter says, it's a network. And, you know, that's why I think it's, and even more so than the foreigners themselves and the ethnic voting blocs, those things are just utilized. Ultimately, there is a regime that is, even as it declines, is sort of continuing to push this. And that's where the tension will lie. Like you mentioned, Epping and Southport and City West. These are sort of flare-ups, rashes, symptoms of a thing kind of coming apart. And we're just watching it happen. In a sense, maybe we've said almost everything that's to be said, but like now it just falls apart, does it? You know, I don't see it hanging together.
The idea, just a brief point as well, from my aspect, and I've said I was a self-professed accelerationist. I hate to say to use the words collateral damage and stuff like that, but to force the change in the narrative, I was always on the assumption that we were always going to have to be on the back of a baton beaten at some stage, that we were going to have to push back at the state at certain points to show the 60% that the state was willing to do this. And I don't think it was planned for, but it was expected. If we'd followed the strategies going forward and the way the Irish state was evolving, it was inevitable that there was going to be a confrontation. So I think we had to drive the narrative even more to encourage more people of the area to come out. And it was such a Coolock, I was involved in the Coolock situation, but it was such a no-brainer because they were so adamant about forcing these. It started off as a number of 300, then numbers went up to 1,000 men going into the old obsolete paint factory. And even when all the different groups in Poland, they came together and by some individuals funding different things, they found out that there was still active asbestos in the building, but still the state wanted to push these people into that place. Still they wanted to go ahead and get them in because they know the value in the destruction of the local cohesiveness that these men would have brought about and would have empowered police to be able to be more on the streets even more, because crime rates would be going through the roof, assaults, all the usuals. And it would empower the guards then to go, well, we need to have more effective presence on the streets. So more bigger patrols. We've got we've got PSNI vehicles down here from the state. We've got three water cannon, 1.8 million. They are expecting it, but we have to, I believe that the point of attending those situations, I'm steering away from protests because I've always been on the assumption that protests are just tacit agreement. Oh, we don't like what you're doing, but we're not going to do anything about it. But I still, they have their effectiveness at the beginning to encourage more people to get to the numbers where it gets to a stage where the state says, well, we have to stamp this out there. This is a flame getting out of control. And by doing that, it expands the flame even more, in my eyes, by doing what they did.
Yeah, there's so much, like, you know, wrong that I suppose it's always worth pointing out, like some of the things you mentioned. You know, we had the girl who was allegedly, we'll say, sexually assaulted in City West. The way that was just sounded like something that one of us would have made up 5 years ago as a caricature of how bad things
are. We knew
are.
It was coming. We obviously were looking at the UK. Yeah. Sorry, Kate. We know it was coming, and we could make the planning. But again, I'm just getting angry at the fact that they're now citing him now as not even ineligible. That he thought she was 18, and that she was the victim blaming again now for a 10-year-old. But what was the other thing in our situation? That was just the time with the Epping. In relation to the Parnell Street attack, now your man is no longer Copus Mendes and will not stand trial for it. Same as this fella here would be mothballed and his situation would be rolled out. And that poor child, irregardless, he said, I thought she was 18. The state going along with it as well. That's what happens with the grooming gangs in the UK. The police victim blamed, said she was drunk and intoxicated at 11 years of age in a group in a room with 23 men. And victim blamed, and we're getting that victim blaming here. And again, we're going to have to show the public that the state will do that again when more serious, the gang rapes start really being perpetuated. The kids that are being grabbed out of the Tusla care homes now and being proffered all around us, that's been going on at dog's age, but it's just become derriere now because we've got third party outside, like them in the Minnesota team, we've got third party drongos being paid by the state to look after vulnerable children, to look after vulnerable enterprises, and they are milking the system and profit them off of victim blaming and trafficking those kids. And we have to make the people see that it will be a nationalist government that will hold that to accountability and bring justice in some way, shape. I know I'm soapboxing there, boys. I just get so agitated about that. But that's the fervor of belief that I believe that accountability will come, and I've refused to allow the black sun to reign supreme. There is always hope. I don't give a fuck what anyone says.
I just mentioned the Ukrainian guy as well. He was he had been here like 2 or 3 days. This is such a little anecdote for the whole thing. He fled Ukraine to avoid the draft, a war that shouldn't be happening in the first place, or he left. Then he comes here and he's in this kind of quasi strange form of state accommodation that if you look into it, these ad hoc forms of accommodation, so it's not an official center, this kind of in between stuff, random African guys, right, scammers effectively, are getting paid like 400,000 euro per child to kind of take care of these people. I bet you anything, if you went to it, it would be a scaldy flat with like someone sitting around asleep scrolling on their phone, nipping out for cigarettes. Ah, you look after yourselves. There's no reason, no one knows where the money is going. And the Somalian who the Ukrainian is staying with stabs him, what, 40 times, gouges his eyes out, kills him.
Jesus,
And that's the level of barbarity that happens sort of just under the surface. We didn't see the video like we did from Charlotte with the young Ukrainian girl there, but it's the same level. I mean, if we had seen the video of that, we'd be traumatized, right? Mm. And this sort of barbarity is happening all over the place. And as people get poorer, it is completely delegitimizing the amount of waste. If you look into the several billion we spend on Ukrainians every year in Ireland, and you just run the numbers, you realize that for the cost of just one aspect of the migration scam, you could have free public transport. You can do it with ChatGPT or look up the figures or whatever and have fun with it. When you pile the billions upon billions, fake Tusla money, Ukrainian grift, if you just do a little exercise for yourself and think of like your top 5 levels of corruption, you end up with like 10, 15 billion, God knows what. And you start thinking, okay, it's not being put towards productive ends. It's just being pissed away. And it doesn't just end at migration. It's other stuff too. Things that wouldn't require a hardcore anti-corruption drive. Just the low-hanging fruit, the worst of the worst. If you took just that stuff, we could have free public transport. This is where the kind of lefty thinking, I think, is useful. Because it's like, there's nothing wrong with that pie-in-the-sky way of looking at it. It's not illogical. We could have free public transport. We could have X amount of houses. We could have this, that, and the other. Our society could be distinctly more advanced and pleasurable to live in than it was 50 years ago because of technological advancement and all the rest of it. But it isn't. It's actually worse than the dreaded 80s people tend to talk about. It's probably worse. And so all of this value, all of this capital is being pissed away on the most, not just pissed away on waste, but destructive things. Like, let's bring in 5,000 Somalians. Let's do this, that, or the other. Let's abuse children and state care. You know, I'm just rambling now, but it's like, you know, things could be so much better. I do believe the resources are there. and none of these toxic policies at all need to be happening. If we just had a hypothetical government of 50 not corrupt people to just administrate things properly, like engineers, like just logically, let's talk about how much better things could be.
And when you talk about all that,
let's blockchain the government. Let's just put it on the blockchain so it's all transparent, and it's Ethereum contracts and contracts with government will all be the certain parameters will have to be met before funds are released, and you can track it back all the way. Let's put the government on digital ID, and let's put the government system on the blockchain, and we can just watch from afar, you know.
Well, they're the only ones who should be really having to have that kind of oversight. When you think about it, government should be the first people that should be held to that kind of accountability. But that's what you're saying. Like, I'm actually a technological optimist because, you know, I think things like AI, like I've been using AI to help me like pull together research that I had done years ago. And I'm like, okay, I'll try all this AI and I'm using these tools. And I'm like, this is actually revolutionary. Like, I can create graphs. I can gather data. I can get to grips with an individual or something so quickly. There's all the artistic aspects of it. Like, I know there's slop. I know most AI is just total shite.
It's in the infancy stage. We're still going through the infancy stage of it all.
But it's all your intention. You know, you can be creative with it. Like, if you're a creative person, you can use it in a creative. It's a tool, you know? And so I think, like, you can't get rid of technology. You have to try and use the technology in the right way. And, you know, if you get ahead on these kinds of things, like, that's... Like, I think a lot of what's happened, you're saying, Garrod, about the economics and we're pissing the money away and we're spending it in such a crazy way. A lot of that has to do with the fact that it's kind of like there's a class of people that have been created. There was a sociologist, he's dead now in Ireland, called Micheál McGrail, and he coined this term, the embourgeoisment of the Irish nation, I think is what he said. And basically what he's saying is that since the liberal period in the 60s, the opening up of the economy coincided with the opening up of mass liberal education. What it means is that we got this kind of technical training. And so there's a huge group of people who are aspirational, and they took on the values of America, basically, this optimistic, we're going to economic determinism, economic, you know, progress at all cost. That's the Derrick meme. If anyone doesn't know about this, is watching outside of Ireland, we have this meme called the Derrick meme. And like Derek is like this like aspirational, you know, kind of, he bought his house in the 90s and he's got a good, things are good, you know, and there's probably an equivalent meme in England for Scotland or whatever for this guy. But he's the guy for things who you know, he has benefited greatly from liberalization, and he loves immigration, and he thinks Ireland is going to be like a hub of technological advancement and everything. And like Derek is kind of that, like, and that's the people have picked up on this because there is a kind of a class thing going on here with this, all this NGO education. There's a certain type of people who have benefited from this, and they have got whole careers. Like in the crash, the Irish government went all in on NGOs, and we're going to shovel more money into it. And what this is like a jobs program for middle class kind of aspirational people with sociology degrees, you know, and they're channeled in and they become change agents. And so all of the direction of our country and every country basically is managed by this class of person. And they're in the arts. They run all the arts council and all this. But see,
it really shows the limits of the middle class, though.
But that's what liberal it is. They're not liberals. They're socialists. They're champagne socialists. And it is. It's welfare for the fucking middle class. Yeah. They came out with these nonsense degrees. And the only people that would employ them was the NGOs because they were already indoctrinated from the system, so they were useful. They gave them that champagne socialist lifestyle, is what I'm saying. You know, it's the minimum degree. I went down to my hairdressers and feng shui did, you know, and then I went down to my nails and the Brazilian did that thing, and it's fucking great. Immigration is great, hasn't affected me, or you know, it only benefits me. You know what I mean? It's a great thing. Keep them coming.
Yeah,
but it's a short term benefit. But yeah, Peter, you were in the middle of a rant there, so sorry.
Basically, it's that class that is the class of people that has been ascendant since, really, I would say since the 80s in particular, like since the EU structural funds came in, and that was basically that all billions poured into this area called community work. And what that is like, you know, you have an NGO basically operating in some community, like. And you think, well, that's great. You know what I mean? You're helping people who are poor or whatever. But actually, if you look at who's running this and who set up this whole sector in Ireland, like, it's basically directed by a bunch of really radical progs and potentially so maybe, you know, far left at whatever as well, you know. And they're operating out of places like Maynooth you know, in particular. And like they actually have an incredibly powerful role and no one is kind of monitoring them. You know, they've been able to come in and like through billions in funding, their graduates are funneled out and they've created a whole institutional layer operating at the very smallest level. If you go into your local town, like there's probably some little Mickey Mouse operation going on that has someone in it who's connected to that structure somewhere in Dublin or in Maynooth or whatever, you know. It's actually crazy to look at. But this is this idea of versus all this social change and everything. This class of person is crucial to it, you know. So like I would say that we have to have a kind of a class analysis, but not a Marxist class analysis, because that's a bullshit dialectical device. It basically just pits the poor versus the aristocracy, basically the old money. And then that separated, that created a new kind of social order. And it's kind of out of that you get the kind of middle class in a way. But like you get this kind of professional middle or whatever in the middle, you know. But yeah, like you have to have a class analysis. You have to say, well, certain groups are benefiting, you know. And so how do you deal with those groups? How do you disenfranchise them? Or how do you take those creative, because they probably are creative people. You know, how do you get those people and kind of de-radicalize them or not, don't train them in that way, train them to be productive for the country, you know?
Cut the money supply, isn't it? It's got to be cut the money supply.
But the other problem is like I'm accused of being a bigot for going on about this, but let's say call it the boomer thing, but it's just on a spectrum of age. It's, you know, you could talk about boomers and say they're over 67 or whatever. I'm not talking about a specific age demographic, but it's just a sliding scale. We have a screen.
Oh, yeah. Just linking with what Peter
I'm working
just
class,
said.
I'm upper class. I have to figure it out. It takes me a sec.
It's okay. Don't worry, Guru. Just go on. Just go on.
No. Wait. I was. I needed a few more seconds. I was almost there. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I actually disagree. Not to be the party pooper, but.
No, we need that.
I mean, ultimately, the guy who's the metropolitan and liberal elite is being paid by a much wealthier strata of people. So I come back to the upper class, to be honest. Again, I'm more traditionally left wing there. You know, the people who are hoarding tens of millions or whatever, I do believe that it's their money, it's their surplus hoarded value, because it's coming from somewhere, pays some NGO guy, what, 60, 70 grand a year, which is relatively good for us pros, but is chump change, really. You know, you can just pay your rent and buy a car. So I don't believe the metropolitan liberal elite is...
Like, when you think about it, the guy like who you're talking about getting paid by the really wealthy, like, he does believe the things he believes. Like, he's not just doing it for the money. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think... I've often kind of dwelled on that. To what extent? Over the years, whether it's some Antifa stooge or an NGO's, wondered about that. And none of us are mind readers. To what extent is it the money, the power, the prestige, the influence, and the access, or is it true belief?
You look at the activists who have targeted you, like, and you've had experiences like that are very like profound. And I know some of these people you're talking about. You know what I mean? And like, I know from looking at their records that they believe profoundly that you need to be destroyed, and me and Torino, all of us, you know, like
it's interesting.
They do hate you. Like, they genuinely hate you, you know, like that. I'm just saying it, like, it is the truth, you know? And like, they're not just doing it for the money, because quite frankly, they could be probably making more money doing something else. Maybe, you know, I don't know. Like I'm saying, they're not making that much money, you know?
Yeah, that's like, it. It's not that much for a lot of them. But then you could say they're not making that much, but the people who are paying them, they're higher ups in the NGOs, they're on 150. And then some of the wealth funds that, you know, the Chuck Feeney Foundation, you know, they're on a lot more. So I suppose maybe they prey on, and Morgoth, our Christmas Eve flagship guest, I got halfway through it earlier.
Gift, yeah, great guest.
But he often spoke, you know, the spiteful mutant and all of that. So maybe some of the underlings, the foot soldiers, they do believe in it. They basically have a negative... control-based, anti-kind of healthy society complex. So then maybe they are true believers, but they are also empowered
By
because they're not just empowered by, let's say, their 60 grand salary. They're empowered by the fact that they get to write an article for the Irish Times and they get to do this, that, and the other. It's the access as well. They're given the access. If they were just a freak, antisocial character on their own, with absent the connection to the power, it wouldn't really mean much. They would actually just be, they would just be kind of marginalized from society. By, like,
Mark Malone yeah. strikes as that type of figure, but very, very much in that vein of that figure. You know, he's paid very well to be antagonistic to all of us and pinpoint to dox us, to throw us out in the streets, utterly protected by the state and in all its different branches, up until the point, and I bring this up, when he was brought into a committee meeting, you remember this, and just by just allowing him to speak, like, he's given the wages, he's an influence of power, he steers Antifa over here in the direction of the people that should be attacked, and when the newbies come up online, he's the force to draw his crowd in to drag them and attack them and vilify them. But when you allow him to speak alone and in front of his stuff, that's when he came up with that term proto-fascism, and he was derided and slapped. So they are true believers, but they're lazy in it now because they're very well feathered. Their nests are very well feathered, and they're given a sphere of influence in their own circle of friends because, you know, he will write that article or they will be that main speaker for the Antifa crowd that we have over here and stuff like that. So there is that class as well, but they're very much the protected provocateurs, if that's a thing. Doesn't fit in a class bracket, but he's very much an agent provocateur in that way.
Totally. Like, how much power would Nick Lowles have if he was writing reports on people saying this person's racist and that person's racist, if it weren't for the Hope Not Hate infrastructure, which is just connected to British intelligence and all that? We wouldn't even know their names. Nobody would. As Aoife Gallagher for the ISD, Institute for Strategic Dialogue, funded by Facebook and hedge funds and everything else. If she were just saying, Garrod tweeted this and Peter tweeted that and Gran Torino tweeted this and they're networking this and that way, okay. But she's in the ISD and she's in the Irish Times and she's on a TV show, and she ultimately, behind all that, she's state-backed or regime-backed. Yeah. And we're just random guys. We don't
You remember the time, though, all of that worked back to Google HQ, and we were getting shadow banned. Or it worked back to old Twitter X, because Susan Gibney or whatever was in, and following up that chain, the head of Twitter at the time, I think it was Susan Gibney, the name strikes the name. She was actually the social media for An Garda Síochána Con before she took up that position.
And so before that, it was the PSNI before that. PSNI before the guards. She had a long chain of working directly with the police and then entered Twitter.
Yeah. Well, to get conspiratorial again and go back to this American thing we started off with, right? That fits exactly into that exact thing, because if you look at the ISD, right, this all comes out of this post-2016 restructuring of the media landscape that happened. So you have populism, you have Trump, Brexit, and then all of a sudden a whole host of these new think tanks pop up, including the ISD, and it full of operatives, quite frankly. Let's be real, like, they're basically operatives. And if you follow the careers of everyone in this institution, it goes back, just like you're saying there with her, that's an example. Like, I can't remember her name. It's not exactly that, is it? I can't remember what it is, but it doesn't matter. We're talking more generally about a type of person here.
Sinead McSweeney. It just came to me.
McSweeney. Go ahead. That's the one. Yeah.
Well done.
And you see, if you trace this all the way back, like, ultimately, it's going back to Washington. Like, this is where this is coming out of, like, and it's coming out of London. You'll find think tanks in London. I found, like, gobshite kind of progs on Irish Twitter who spend their whole day tweeting about the far right, and basically they're producing articles for obscure think tanks in America focused on populism, and they link it to counter-extremism, and it all goes back to things like the Atlantic Council, Washington, D.C., you know, NATO in Brussels. This is where this shit is coming from, you know, EU commission funded stuff, you know. And of course, you can see how the tech infrastructure ties into all that, you know, because they're basically running that. I mean, it was said in the 60s and all that, like, most of the editors of the mainstream media were basically on the books of either CIA or MI6 or whatever it was, you know. And that's common. The head of the Irish Times in the 80s and all was an MI6 agent. That's, there's a guy called David Burke in Ireland who writes books all about how they were targeting Haughey. I'm obsessed with the Haughey story because I actually look into it. He has books all about it now. I researched this years ago, the little bits that I was able to dig out, and you can find out about how they were managing the media, how they were managing all this stuff, you know. And it's like, with this, all these tech companies, it's the exact same thing, except it's this more sophisticated. So you have something like, you know, you'll have Storyful, you know, founded by an Irish guy, Mark Little, you know, comes back to Ireland with this, oh, I just got this Storyful set up, guys. I'm just going to manage all the media. You know, it's going to manage all what you're up to say on the internet. We're going to fact check and all this fact check and all this stuff. It all goes back to that structure in coming out of America and London, pretty much, you know. That's where it comes from.
Yeah, the question is, again, comes back to the restructuring of Twitter under Musk. You know, you can't, the idea that you go, yeah, I know, it was so controlled. I know you're not saying this, Peter, and none of you are, but like, it was so controlled, and there's this network system, and it controls our society and revolutionizes our belief systems and controls the discourse. But it was interrupted all of a sudden by this man with a little paddle in his hand at a bidding auction who happened to have the most money and said, I'll take it over, Elon Musk. I just found that crazy, as if Jack Ma in China could just outbid the CCP to control Weibo, and they would just, this all-powerful entity would just kind of let that happen.
Yeah, that's great.
Because
he won
at the auction. He had the most, you know, Musk, the, what's his name, Tony Stark figure, a total maverick, just outbid them, outfoxed them at the auction. And I mean, they would just say, oh, well, he, you know, highest bidder, now he can take an anti-regime stance for the whole Western world through the public square. Come on now. Like, you know, it's fishy. It's still fishy.
Until a few months before the election. And all of a sudden he just goes in behind Trump. And now we have to back him no matter what, you know. Mm. And I think it's cool that Twitter has opened up. I'm just going to use it, whatever. You know, I'm probably going to pay for the premium thing to stream on it because there's pretty
audience. Yeah, look at it now. Look at all that pro-European bots, and they've all got check marks now. Every time, as you said earlier on at the beginning of Garrod, you went to your For You is just ablaze with pro. I had a photograph saved there now of the kind of like a Statue of Mary figure and a child with a halo of stars around them looking at the European flag. The nonsense, the slop that's coming out of that, but it's so projected. It goes back to millennials' point of it's so contrived now and so obvious that even when it shows up on Twitter, because there's a huge amount of money, just the bot farms are being active and these accounts are obviously AI driven because there's a little bit of narration, but it's so pro-European. It's disgusting that they would even think that people, like, you could see straight through it. You know what I mean? You must have seen that, Chris.
But what if it's too, like, what if the point is to actually just break it all up and to just make it so that no one can really gain any foothold? You know? Like, that could be actually the strategy where you just flood the zone with, like, a whole load of voices, all bullshitting. And, like, if I honestly, like, I haven't followed the Candace thing, you know, you're talking about before. I don't really know what the story about all that is, for example. But I'm kind of thinking, like, doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't really know what I'm going to do with this information. If it turns out that Cork was whacked by the fucking Mossad or something, like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, that does not move the needle for me in any kind of way. Like, I mean, and it's probably not likely that it happened. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it always seems to be, I noticed this a couple of years ago with the Trump thing, like, where all of a sudden it's all about a laptop or a fucking, the Biden laptop. The fucking Wiener laptop. We've all these laptops and like 10 more minutes, 2 more weeks, you know. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you're just on the phone, like, you know, what's coming on with the Wiener laptop, you know, and everyone's going to be locked up and like it doesn't happen. And then you're kind of going, like, well, what was the point of all that? You know, were we just sucked into a fucking time waste? Are they just playing for time? Like, you're kicking for the end line and you're kicking for the touch, like, and
Brexit.
Yeah. Perfect. I was all into Brexit too, like, at the time. Like, yeah, I was way in favor of it. Like, you know, I did videos. Some of the earliest videos I did were saying that Brexit's great, you know what I mean? And, you know, and now I've kind of developed a more kind of, especially when you look at what happened to Britain after Brexit, where, well, it's just an excuse to get more Commonwealth immigrants in. And it's like, well, this is the opposite of what you wanted, you know? And Britain is probably economically worse than anyone in Europe nearly at this point, you know, from what I'm hearing. You know, I'm not.
Yeah, big IMF bailout. They're going to be looking for money already. While they keep sending it over to Ukraine, It's going to be a big, that's what I'm saying, there's going to be financial reckoning of some sort. And are they going to corral us and steer us into the CBDCs, all that kind of jazz, and then kind of mix it up with the different currencies from the Russia and all the what's that called? Can't think of BRICS. Yeah. BRICS, yeah. With BRICS and all of that coming into play. You know,
so. Can I just ask a question I want to ask Colin? Because I assume England, Britain, Ireland, you know, much the same in the overall cultural changes. Have any of you noticed, or is it just me? Maybe I'm just depressed, right? That in the last, maybe the last 6 years post-COVID, let's say, through all of that, but maybe the last 10 years, ramping up along the way, up to this moment, that if you go out to, let's say, a supermarket, nice little petri dish of ordinary society, people buying their food, people look like they have got PTSD, like they've just emerged from World War One. Just the look on people's faces. I always say, like, if you could time travel from the mid-90s, an average supermarket, to now, and you could take away the kind of how you become inured to it gradually over time so you don't notice, and you just time travel from a 1998 supermarket, and just small things, everything would be the same. There's food on the shelves, you know, people walking around, but the subtlety of the look on people's faces, I'd say, would shock you stone cold if you had that one to the other experience. Is that just me? Am I losing it?
It's funny you mentioned World War One, because I recently wrote an essay which required quite a lot of research about that exact moment, like 1919, 1920. And it seems like there was actually a lot of optimism and happiness because the war was over, so there was peace. So I think that's actually not a good
I'll just correct. If they had just come from the trench, literally.
I get the point. I'm just noting the irony, because I think people were actually happier in 1919 than they are now.
Definitely.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that I think about this quite a lot, you know, because it's so easy to forget. You can remember, well, I'll speak for myself. I can remember this particular event, that particular event, and how they relate to each other in time, which is a sort of obsession of mine. But I'm very bad at remembering a general tenor, like what was the mid-90s like. I've got a notion of it. I've got like images of it, but it's very difficult to remember a general tone of like how did it differ from today. However, I've seen it in my adulthood. I can remember my adulthood more easily. So, you know, the last 20 years, and yeah. I do think, I mean, I've said this so many times now, but I'll say it again now because it's relevant. You used to hear people saying all the time, it's a free country. And nobody ever says that now. And I also think there was a general optimism or complacency about the future. And I can remember the second half of the 90s when I was an adolescent, teenager. And there was a sense that, you know, the future was going to be great. We were going to be buying brand new CDs forever. Every one of them would be a new instance of the standing wave of cultures. That's what it was like in the 90s. And then, you know, I don't want to go into this because it's a whole other thing, but it's probably related to what you're saying. Everything just stopped. Like that standing wave of culture just suddenly froze around about the early 2000s. And we've been there ever since. In terms of culture, there have been no new genres, no new design aesthetics, nothing.
We did get the flat culture, flat kind of that flat design where it's like all the kind of shaping people in the diverse.
That was hellish. Yeah, and that was really peaked at COVID. And now culture has changed in other ways since 2000. Dramatically. I mean, we are not living in the same culture that we were in 2000. But it hasn't changed in the way that we were accustomed to it changing, which is basically new ideas. But that's a whole other thing. Just generally optimism about the future and comfort in the here and now, comfort in the present. I think those have just gone. And I do agree with you, because I think that, and it probably would be visible You see, in people's faces, if you could travel back in time and just compare the two directly, I think you would see a difference. I think in general, we would probably all be shocked to if we could do that, if we could compare these eras. I think we would be shocked at how many differences there are, not just technological ones, you can take those for granted, but even in terms of how people relate to each other, how polite people were, how well-spoken people were, how knowledgeable people, general knowledge. I think all of that has weirdly gone downhill. Well, some aspects of it are weird because general knowledge, you'd think that would have increased with Google and ChatGPT, but it doesn't seem to have. And then others like manners and all of that, that's just the decline of what we used to call Western civilization. So yeah, but I think you asked specifically about optimism and just general joie de vivre. And yeah, I think that. I think especially since COVID, people are just worn out. They're just exhausted.
Yeah, okay. So it's just as bad in England as it is here. I suspect it might be slightly worse, the rot.
I think so, yeah.
Interesting.
I just pick up an analogy. I was in the UK, because you invoked that memory there just when you were speaking there. I was in the UK in 96, and I'm just relaying the time and the sensation, the feeling, because when you remember Euro 96, living in the UK at the time, it was such a euphoria in England. I was then Milton Keynes because they were progressing. Again, it was a football, but keeping it in a cultural aspect. It was the time when Rule Britannia was said a reckless abandonment, and everybody Britpop was included in that. Yeah, Britpop. And I'm saying that it kind of works its way. You said that the loss of that culture. To me, the first strike against that happy period from 96 to 2000 was Y2K. Y2K was the first shock trauma on the populace of, is everything going to stop? Will all the clocks be reset? Will they go 00 and everything just stops? And again, we were kind of taken away from that happy euphoric stage, like we got so far, it's coming home. The Gallagher brothers were reigning supreme. The Britpop wars were running amok. You know, people were different. As you say, the culture wars were going on. Everybody had their own fashion sense. It was a different fashion sense, but it was still all unifying from living in it there at that time under the one flag. It was all under the British flag, or it was under the Union Jack. You know, and then after the 2000. Was when I noticed, because I was living there, because there was such a shock in the populace. It was such a, wow, this is technical. That's when I think that first strike or the first assault on people's consciousness to book them out of that comfort zone.
And in a way, it's the first kind of time to cut across. Sorry, but I guess you bring up a good point there with the Y2K, because that is actually the first time I can remember where the internet became real, like a thing that actually affects your real life. Because up until that point, I don't think people were buying tickets on the internet yet, were they, for like planes and all, really? They weren't. It was kind of like you had to, Ryanair might have been doing it, maybe, you know, just early days. But I think most people, you had to ring up on the phone to order like a plane or go to a travel agent. Like, and whereas Y2K was like all over the media. Like, and I remember that I was quite young, obviously. I would have been, what, 14 or whatever. But like, I remember very clearly that like people were like worried that their computers, legitimately, the technology is going to stop. Mm. Planes will fall out of the sky. Like, it was the first time the internet was presented to you as not just a science fiction thing. Because up until that point, it was like nerd culture, you know. Games were nerd culture. Games only became mainstream, like, after that point, really. Before that, it was pretty much nerd culture up until the 90s, really, wasn't it? Like, so.
Yeah, it's one of my earlier memories. I was 8. So it was just kind of very vague.
4 gigabytes on RAM on that thing as well, and it was probably worth a fortune now. 4 gigabytes of RAM, if that.
It wouldn't be 4. I can guarantee it was not 4. Like that. It'd be half a gig if that. But yeah, that's really interesting that Rowan mentioned Euro 96, because I've never been into football, but even I can remember Euro 96. 1996 was a really hot summer.
Was that Southgate with the penalty? Was that?
I have no idea.
Remember Gaza goal up over the other shoulder, banging in goals. People were drinking, watching the game. And what was that? There was a very popular TV show on at the time as well. And when that Gaza goal was scored, well, go ahead.
Was it not after Gaza's time? I thought he was more like late '80s, early '90s. Well, maybe.
I'm thinking.
But yeah, absolutely. And I remember Britpop, Blur, Pulp, and Oasis, and all of that. We can don't need to get into that now. But I think the general point is, yeah, that there was tremendous optimism, and yeah, it was kind of shallow. The sort of Cool Britannia and all that. It immediately went rotten once Tony Blair walked into Downing Street, but it was there. And and then Y2K, immediately all of this stuff, like the Millennium Dome was a disaster. And there was another thing, a sort of University of Industry or something that New Labour were doing, and it just collapsed as well. That they had these huge ideas, but meantime they were revolutionising the country anyway, like the House of Lords and the Human Rights Act and all of that. So yeah, it's and that was the start. That was the start of that was the sort of birth, the inception of the era that we're now living in and still living in. Multiple governments after New Labour, we're still in that moment.
We have such an age, like I was getting into it a while ago, but the whole age thing, I was talking about boomers and how it graduates down the timeline. That's a big thing. Maybe this is inherent to every society, I don't know, but it feels this way to me that the last, maybe, I don't know, last 20 years, thereabouts, 25, somewhere there, our lifetimes, boomers now, a lot of them are very comfortable, right? They have a property or two, not all of them, but all sorts of grants and assistances and all. Like, I don't know many boomers who are not very happy with their lot, right? A lot of them have done well. They could have done not much in their careers and they're pretty, like, happy-clappy now, or relatively stable, versus I'm 34, right? I'm like, I look at a 24-year-old, it's a radically different picture to a 24-year-old, to a 34-year-old, or a 44-year-old. I don't know if we're all exactly the same age, but we're millennial-ish people, and some Gen X are caught in this
grief
of a vague... of a vague...
55 over here, just to clarify.
Yeah, no. I'm a Zoomer as well. The grief, that's a big thing for millennials, which is weird, sort of stumbling around with grief and Gen X, of like a time that they remember from childhood a little bit, but we didn't even get to grab onto it. We didn't get close enough. And then you have like maybe someone who's 40, a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them are actually doing okay if they bought their property.
Yeah, if you get the house started, like, that's the thing. Yeah, anyone around 40-ish, like I've seen this because that's my age, basically, that I'm that bracket. And like, basically I look down and I look up and the people below me that are younger, holy fuck, like I don't envy them. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
I really don't envy them. And then I think like there's all these kind of older people, like, and I've seen it with the boomer thing, like, because like people get on to me about using this term the whole time. You stop going after, it's not an age thing necessarily. It's just that there's just a lived reality that if you're within a certain age, you cannot, it's harder for them to visualize what your life is like. Whereas I can see, because I've done the gig economy. I've been, you know, had to do the roughest jobs, you know, and like, I don't have like a good job or anything like, but I'm okay because I got certain things ticked off the list, you know, before the barrier was pulled up, you know, or whatever put in place.
Not an assurity. That's still not a guarantee because we understand the globalist property rights is number one under attack. Property tax means you'll never exclusively own your property outright. So, yeah, like the boomer waffen may have can afford the comfortability and see themselves out into the next life. Maybe Gen X is in the hall. Not all of them have a house, but they're going through that stage now where marriages break down. It's at that timeline where people get past the 40s and the children start getting a little bit older. That's when couples start to break up. That's when housing stocks gets dissolved, and any sort of external pressures on that market will force it into the hands of the vulture funds and then the bigger market players. Because our housing stock, as we know, is being sold en masse in block. So that's why the single 21-year-old can't get at it now. But I you know, you keep saying that they're fucked and stuff like that as well. And we do that, but to encourage them, because in all situations and in all situations like that, adaptability comes into play. There different situations will come into play where they'll bypass or get around that housing market strategy, or, you know, they'll get more activated because they're at the very precipice of owning nothing and being extremely unhappy about the whole situation. So I say your age group as well, Peter, but particularly below you, are more active. We see it on the European yeah. front. We see it with the Nick Fuentes arc and the Groypers coming in, and that transposes over to European context as well, because there's a whole militia, and I say that word, of young men that are coming into the fray now, and we have to be emboldened by that and encourage it even more. So there will be maybe a block purchase of houses for themselves. They'll accrue their wealth together and manage it, like what the Indians do when they come over. They come in mass, they all share one house, the 12. They all pool resources and buy the house next door. They make it so uncomfortable for the neighbours on the street that eventually they force them all out, like cuckoos and stuff like that. So we need to encourage encourage that age group to do the exact same thing and banding together. And they might be there at the precipice of a viable political, if there is such a thing, a political outcome.
Well, you have to stop the immigration to do that. But go ahead, sorry.
We do. That's why I feel like, if I criticize boomers, I want to have a sense of custodianship or whatever, because I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm not doing amazing. I'm not homeless, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like I'm grand enough on the spectrum, let's say. But I look at the 25-year-old now who's, you know, they don't have a hotshot job. They're just average, you know. That's not a crime, right? And they're looking at the situation like, what the fuck am I going to do?
Yeah.
I've seen
people that were not, like you're saying, didn't have good jobs in the 80s and all, and they did basic things like, I owned a shop, and they did really well. They became really wealthy out of that. It was possible. People don't realize this now when you're a bit younger, like, but people used to be able to run very normal businesses and be very wealthy.
I've seen people who worked in a shop, people who worked in a shop, never mind owned it, worked in a shop in the 80s, the husband had a similar job, maybe, or vice versa. And it's like, they, you know, you fast forward 10, 15 years, they were doing grand. They lived in their house. It was grand. No problem. Whereas now, I would say for like young people, they just have to do whatever they have to do, you know, by hook or by crook almost. But there was this one interesting thing. I remember talking to a guy who had it was on Twitter. We were going back and forth. He was actually asking me for advice. And I told him at the outset, I don't really know, to be honest, but he said, like, I have a degree, I'm doing a job that should pay well, but it doesn't, and it's not going to anytime soon. I have no idea how I'm going to get stuck in on the property ladder and all that. And I said, I have this theory of, like, well, when you're 18, you just go on the dole. You just flat, you know, arrange your marriage and have your kids and do everything, so you just get handed a house and just live off the state. Because if you try, you'll have to really do well to get to succeed. But
we can't encourage that in any way, shape, or form, Gerald. We have to get people off the state teeth and reliable on themselves.
No, I know, but
then they're just paying the dole for everyone else. Like, I mean, I'm not on the dole, but I actually am a pro dole maxer. Like, I will tell you, this is not a great country to be working in many ways. Do you know what I mean?
No, and it's not. Like you probably
healthcare, you know, getting insurance. Like, it's unreal for a family. Like, do you know what I mean? Like.
You don't want to be in a position where you can't afford health insurance, but you are way over the line for a medical card, right? Nobody's going to come to your rescue then. Nobody's going to say, oh, well, you know, then you're just in the middle because you tried, but you didn't do well enough, let's say, right? And the same could go for housing. But the guy, just the interesting thing is that the guy said to me, and not to get classist, you know, I was raised on a council estate and all of that, right? I've no dog in the fight either way. But just he said to me, I said, like, you know, what about that approach? You're not that old. I'm not suggesting it to you. It's your own thing. I'm just saying, if you don't know what else to do, that's just one of those ideas that we've been floating. And he said, well, he said, I'm of a certain class. He's kind of middle class, maybe even a little bit upper middle class, just, you know, that kind of way. Suburban kid, decent family, working parents, all that stuff. And he said, it's not so simple, because how am I supposed to approach a woman in my social and cultural bracket and say, I've got an idea for you. Do you want to go on the dole? You live at your mam's. We'll both go on the dole. You live at your mam's. We'll break up. But then you'll get the house by, like, being at the office and for a few years. And then eventually they put you in the house as a single mother. And then I move back in and we'll play that whole game. He was just saying, I can't find a woman who I could get on with, who I share any background with, and just become an intergenerational social welfare person, let's say. I can't just do that. It wouldn't work. And it dawned on me. I was like, oh, yeah, so you just can't do that either, let's say. It's just not something you can just press a button when you're 19 and, you know, go through a grand strategy of playing the state. So it's like, you know, you talk about Indians will group up and all that, but for a middle-class Irish person, where are they going to find 12 Irish lads who are culturally in for that? You know, it's like, who are you going to meet? Whereas for Indians, it's already baked into their kind of strategy. So I'm just saying, like, people under the age of, I don't know, maybe 30 are so adrift. And that's where the boomer thing comes in, is the gap of understanding. Yeah, even I sometimes struggle to understand. Never mind somebody who's 70.
They actually cannot, like, I've had the conversations like this. I'm sure you've had yourself, like, and you try and explain, like, to someone of that age, like, listen, like, you know, first of all, like, I mean, when I left school, for example, like in the early 2000s, I could literally like rent an apartment with a couple of people like for like 60 quid a week. You know, you could have a very regular job doing that. You didn't need to have any fancy job. I had a car. I was able to buy a car. I was able to keep a car on the road, have a little apartment in town, and you have a good life. Go out, bring the girlfriend and wherever, go off, go out in the beer, you know, sleep in the car. All of these little experiences, like, you know, do you want to get a hostel? What, 15, 10 or a night, you know, in a hostel, this kind of thing. These kinds of experiences have basically kind of begun to disappear since the recession ended. Like, and it's like, to me, this is like the cost of all of that, like ECB stimulus, all of this quantitative easing, all of this immigration inflation, which is what this really is. This is a way of it. It's a way of driving inflation through immigration. So you have economic inflation through currency, and then you have immigration inflation, which you can map this on, like the price of houses directly correlates with the rise of the population due to immigration since about 2015, 16 is when that began, that bubble began.
There's a whole cohort of statistics that correlate with that graph change as well. Crime rates, hospital queues, all of that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's other things. All these negative social indicators have mapped directly onto these consequences. Do you know what I mean? And I see, like, the older generation, like, because they're focused on, because traditionally it was the older people who had the hardest time in Ireland and in Britain. It was the same. People all have this thing in their head of old people are poor, but actually it's the opposite. Like, old people are much wealthier in Ireland now, like, than they were a generation previously, and certainly back in the 60s and 70s, like, when the pension was tiny, you know. But so it's hard for them to get into this thinking, change in thinking, like, where they have to say, actually, no, I've been really benefit. See, people don't want to believe that they got lucky, right? Like, people who, you know, there's this culture of like, oh, you know, I was the property developer and I built a house and then I sold a house and I'm such, I understand property. I'm in real estate. And people were saying that in the 90s and all. And what they were basically saying, they weren't really in these markets. This was just a bubble that through sheer generational luck, you happened to be born between the 40s and the 70s. And so you were able to basically ride this thing. It's like, oh, the house is after going up at 50 grand. I'll just sell it and build another one. Like, that's just sheer luck. That's not like, you're not some business genius. Every boomer thinks they're a fucking like building expert and a business genius simply for having been born at the right time.
And they all grew out of their equity out of that boom as well. They all took the equity out of that and deprived the generational. That's when they started to become really selfish, when they started to say, I can dip into the equity. You know what I mean? Yeah. I could start to buy a new car. What about the kids' phone? What about the kids' car? Oh, fuck the kids. You know what I mean? They'd be grand. Nothing's going to change.
Everything's going
to get started to get really selfish on it as well.
Yeah, but that's why everything is going to keep going. Go ahead.
That's why the system of let's say, like, I don't know, maybe we're totally off here, but, you know, the, like, let's say something like someone buys a house, like two people sitting in work, they have the same job, the same pay. One person is living with their parents, a 25-year-old, and the 40-year-old is in actually the same role, let's say, hypothetically. And one, the older person is living in a much better house and paying half the mortgage as the person sitting next to them. That is a generational kind of divide that just completely alienates people. You know, a person could be living either in a hovel or their parents' house, and it's like, but I'm paying more for my mortgage or my rent, significantly more than you're paying. But somehow you're... Yeah, for nothing. Like, it's like, that's something that just completely alienates generations, whether it's a 45-year-old from a 25-year-old or so on. You know, that's a toxic, toxic thing. And I'm always trying to personally, I wish, you know, boomers, we, trying to look backward, like trying to look down and try to understand where the 25-year-old in the shop is at. I do believe that's the kind of future, in a way, of politics is to, or discourse, is to try to look downward in age and try to understand their concerns. And
very hard bridge the gap, Garrod, you know, because the boomer often are so affluent, they're so distracted, they travel the world, they're reliving their youth again two or three times over, and they've no sympathy for the 25-year-olds. Get a job, what are you going to do?
Lost cause. They just have to phase out, and not to be crass about it. I think it's all about looking at 20 to 30, 30 to 40, whatever, the generations who are coming up, the remaining natives who we have left, where are they at? What are their concerns?
I'll just interject here, Garoda, because I think it'll probably end up being the case that the boomer generation is an anomaly, an aberration, because they were so, and not all of them, of course, but in general, they were so self-obsessed, like they didn't really care about preserving what their ancestors had left them, and they didn't care about passing anything down to their kids. But that was to do with the sheer comfort and luxury and wealth of their time as the young adults. So they just assume that it's always like that, and younger generations are dealing with the same luxury and wealth and prosperity. But of course, we're not. And so I think that what will probably emerge now is a general presumption that you don't fucking get a cruise in your 60s and spend half your pension and the equity from your house on some, I don't know, speedboat or sports car that you absolutely don't need. What you do is you conserve as much of your wealth as possible so as to pass it down to the next generation. I think that's going to become a general presumption between the younger generations from now on.
It's the other thing is a large generation. That's the problem, because they have warped culture to suit. Like, if you look at it, like, politics and culture has been warped because they were such a large generation that as they began to rise, like in the 60s and kind of through the 70s, and then they're in middle age, kind of in the 80s and 90s, like the whole society has warped to kind of accept, oh, here's the Rolling Stones every decade, you know what I mean? Or whatever, you know, that's the kind of, although I actually like the Rolling Stones, apparently. But like the thing with the culture is just totally warped by that, because every product was marketed so much to that powerful economic demographic that has money, that has, you know, the ability to wield power, like, you know, and so they have a lot of cultural clout, you know.
But so, like, families as well are going to have to, the other thing with the boomer thing and the changes, like we're going to, you know, no more speedboats and all that, is that families, if they're to survive, and like a lot of families aren't being formed, but the few who are like scratching around among the ruins kind of thing from here on in are going to have to change the dynamic, because life expectancy and life preservation with pills and surgeries and all that, I might not last this long, but let's say I live to be 90 or something standard, like a lot of us will. And your children have children when they're 30, we'll say. So my kids will have their kids when they're 30. I'll be 60-something. I've got another maybe 20, 30 years to go. Touch wood, let's say. I can consolidate my assets for them. But of course, if I'm going to live to be 85 or 90, it's too late. Because they need to have their kids when they're 30, right? And I'm still going to be alive for another 20, 25 years. So there's going to have to be, which is something, of course, boomers never got, that if you want to pass down the lineage, it has to happen a different way. So I think there'll be a lot more like intergenerational living and families who have a bit of money, you know, building, you know, the whole thing of four houses on one property in, I don't know if you have that in Britain so much, but it's a huge thing in Ireland where the farm has like four properties, you know, those ones. They become like a little feudal network, and they are to survive. But the people who are lost are unmoored. I think, you know, back in the day, it was great to live in that little feudal farm estate. But I think in future, it'll have to be like that more. You'll have to have various generations kind of coinciding along together, liquidating assets or building them together. And that was all well and good. But now it's that if that doesn't happen, people will just be straight up fucked.
I'll tell you, like, you know, for certain demographic, that actually never stopped. There's certain groups like that if you look at the upper middle class and the upper classes generally, like they're actually, they tend to marry people of their own class. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so they actually do. This is the kind of really perverse thing about the whole multicultural experiment and the inflation, the economic inflation and the culture of saying to people, just go out and, you know, get out, break away and do this and do that. And if you're not out of your house, you're a loser. You know, everyone's a loser now, you know. And there's this kind of, there's this new, I've noticed since the advent of like the kind of Zoomers coming powerful as a demographic online with TikTok and all the rest of it, like that there is this culture now of striving. Everyone is a striver and you have to be like climbing some like economic thing. And it's like, you know, have you seen this guy going around, the LuxMax guy, and he's after driving over some guy or whatever, but like everyone's laughing about him because he's doing all this stuff to look good and trying to
clavicular. I'm still up on the fucking, yeah. I'm still up on this. I'm in the culture.
Yeah, there you go. We're down with the kids, like, you know what I mean? We're down with the kids. We're cool. Like, you know, we're honorary Zoomers. But like the thing with like that is that it's that the whole thing that he's doing, like that's like the most exaggerated version of this paradigm, like that he's actually on sync with what the culture is telling young people, like, which is that, you know, you have to become this dog eat dog thing. The only, you have clout if you have a big social media following and if you have money, and if you don't, you're a loser. And so if you have these, like, you know, kind of older values or whatever, you just have to get with. That's why I think Andrew Tate is deployed, you know, because Andrew Tate kind of embodies this kind of thing of, you just got to get, you know, pull all the women and, you know, everyone can be a fucking pickup artist and everyone can do this and that. And to me, this is just like, it's a way of making young people accept what is a ridiculous situation, like that they shouldn't have to accept. Like, they shouldn't have to accept not being able to buy a fucking home. Okay, you don't have to earn six figures a year to have a normal fucking life. Like, this is just bullshit. It was never that way for your grandparents. Like, my grandparents lived in a council house and they were able to buy that council house in the 80s. And they had five kids and they lived happily. They were well-reared, you know. Yeah, they weren't rich, but you know what? They all died happy, you know. And I'm kind of going like, I think a lot of this online culture is given, is deployed to kick young people and to suck them into this way of thinking, you know.
Individualism, so, like it's your problem to fix. I like that whole Jordan Peterson thing of, don't worry about the world, worry about cleaning your bedroom and fixing yourself. It's like, there's an extent to which, of course, that's true. You mustn't over focus
it's true but it's kind of useless as well.
Well, it's just it goes both ways. You don't want to focus on the system at the peril of your own agency. But you also don't want to focus too much on your own agency, so-called, at the peril of not seeing the wood from the trees, the system itself. Like, you should know how dispossessed you are and how totally unnecessary it is, and how you don't need to be a hustling six-figure LuxMaxer. Actually, that's abnormal. That's freakish. You should just be able to work some job. It generates value. You get enough value to buy a house and buy your tools and live your life. That's it. And if it's not like that,
I'm maxing. I'm just doing it now.
Oh yeah. It freaks me out. The look is weird. The look is so weird. No, they look like fucking like transgender individuals, I'll call them.
Yeah.
Kind of just Hunger Games.
It's gay code. Obviously, sorry.
Yeah. Somebody made an interesting point a few minutes ago when we were talking about the boomers, and somebody said, let me see if I can find it now. But even on Rumble, the chat is moving so fast now that I can't keep up with it.
What have you got watching, Woz? How many is watching, roughly?
I can only... well, hold on a minute. On Rumble, it's 280. On Odyssey, it's 140. And on Twitter, it's 1780. An awful lot on Twitter. I don't know how accurate that
17K is on my feed there, Millennial. I got 1.7 on.
Yeah.
I heard it was 20,000.
Well, maybe it is somewhere. I can't see it, but I doubt it's 20K. That's an awful.
I'm just exaggerating for effect.
Yeah.
Pump the numbers up, like.
All right. Okay. Sorry. I was not quick enough to. Yeah. But anyway, somebody made the point that, paraphrasing, American boomers are much worse than British, and, you know, boomers on this side of the Atlantic, because here they actually had rationing from World War II up until 1954. So they didn't emerge into a land of plenty, they initially had to struggle. Their first memories are of struggle. And I think that's a very good point, because I think sometimes on that there's a danger that we on this side of the Atlantic get caught up in the narrative about boomers from America.
Mm.
And so, because they are definitely worse there. There's no question of it. You know, I think about the boomers I've known, and yeah, they're materialistic. Yeah, they're deracinated. I mean, they can't, the idea of peoplehood means nothing to them. Yeah. Yes, they are materialistic. But they're not selfish, the ones that I've known. They're not ruthless, and they did want to pass stuff down to their kids and grandkids. So I don't think it's, I think it's more of it's a worse thing in America than here. Then again, I know people in Britain whose parents are just blowing everything on cruises in their 60s and 70s. So that phenomenon does exist on this side of the Atlantic, and it's astonishing.
Imagine going on a cruise. Oh my gosh. Like, and especially if you're like,
all being done away now. Black fatigue. That's all. Forget about the cruises. They're going to have to move on to something else now, because that's all been taken over.
We wild.
Wine, like vineyard tours. I think that's a big one as well.
Well, they've been.
Oh, yeah. Well, this has been a great chat. I feel like we could just go on and on, but there are some super chats, so I'll put those to you, and then maybe we'll head towards wrapping up, because some of these super chats have been waiting for a long time. Okay, so we're going to go back to some topics from earlier. Ranulf said, can we effectively separate sympathy for the victims of Zionism from a willingness to let them into our countries? Our government's support for Israel gives them an excuse to come into our countries. And this guy's from America. He's talking from that perspective. But what he's saying clearly applies here as well, in Britain and Ireland. So can we separate sympathizing with Palestinians without letting them into our countries? I think we can. I mean, the short answer is yes, we can, because to quote Barack Obama, because we can simply look into supporting them closer to where they're coming from. They don't need to bring them over here. And I think this is a whole misconception that the only way to help third worlders is to bring them into the West. And it's actually crazy.
They're being instrumentalized, but that's what's going on, is they're being instrumentalized by the structures that we were talking about earlier, basically, all these networks and everything. These migrant crisis in 2015 showed that. Like, this is obviously a manufactured crisis. Obviously, there was a series of NGOs here putting up stopping points, phone charging stations, particular routes are being basically marked.
The whole infrastructure was created for that. It was astounding. But yeah, it's actually, I believe, I've read this, that it's cheaper to help them. It's much cheaper to sustain them, to keep them fed in, like, let's say, Africa, than to bring them here. Because,
20-1 was the figure back in the day. 20-1, for one person, you kept here for the same price and value for keeping one person here, you could help 20 back from whence they came.
Also,
that might be true.
The likes of probably Palestine, certainly Lebanon, Libya, Iraq, Syria, were they, this is a very anti-neocon talking point, but it's obviously true if you look at it, if they had just been left alone, I believe they would be fine societies now, destinations, right? Baathist Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Paris of the Middle East,
Libya,
Iran, but these places would be fine. They're not inherently barbarian or something like that. They were being run okay,
but they were exploited. They were the primary targets of exploitation as well for the globalist infrastructure. You know, to get that displacement of population, there had to be massive wars to go on. And
I would love to live in Gaddafi's Libya. If you study, I mean,
when I studied that, like every family had 8 grand per child. He paid because uber nationalism, and we were. When I look back and when I came to understand it, how betrayed we all were about who he was, actually, no true saint, no dictator is a true saint. But you can only go by the population. And just to recap, for anyone who doesn't know, the aquaplane system that he was building up was going to regreen Africa, which would have turned it into the bread basket for it, for itself. Libya would have been the bread basket for the African continent. They were so oil rich, and that the oil rich, the oil money was so pumped back in, the natural resources were given back to the populace, even under a it wasn't a puritanical sort of Islam that Libya kind of did. It was still Bedouin sheep herders, and they still had that kind of tribal aspect. But he was cute enough to know to drive all the money back and give them primacy that they'd never had to get. Like the Saudis get now. No Saudi gets around. No, they keep 99.9% of their phones. He did the same sort of thing. He wanted to start a farm. He bought you the whole lot.
Mm-hmm. That he was kind doing of that African United African initiative, yeah, whatever it was called, with the gold dinar and everything, which was basically, I believe, the reason he was taken out.
You know? It was central bank. It's banker warfare. It's again, he didn't want a central bank, pretty much like Russia doesn't. They have their own central bank. I think they completely control it, but it's banker wars again. He was gonna separate the African breadbasket away from Western control and bring it more nativism back into it again as well. And what we have, that kind of restructure coming around now with Burkina Faso and what he's doing over there, Traore. And again, if anybody of the other persuasion or any of the gentrified Africans that are watching here who are proudly extol their Irishness, why aren't you going back over there volunteering for his army and rebuild Africa and be proud of who you are and go back and rebuild Africa, help build the roads, do all of that. But to finish off on that point, there was all banker wars. Obviously, he was taken out because the global warfare was coming on to displace all them populations, to drive them to Africa. I firmly believe this Jones plantation is being minimized and that all the world's ill are being ring-fenced into the European nation, because we're going to be desolate. When this war finally does conclude, we are going to be back to the 80s. We're going to be worse than the 80s in regards to financial decline. And then when they come up with their Hegelians of whatever, the electronic cash, when the fiat currency does actually kind of crash. But we are being micromanaged into being smaller and to try and get by with less. You know what I mean? So that the Jones plantation is being effectively squeezed and bringing more, where they're going to outsource as many people out of Africa as they can and push it into Western Europe to make that mocha-coloured, nebulous population that has no affinity or allegiance to one county or one country, you know, through the Berggrave and demographics. But I suppose once all of us capable people or people that can recognize, and once we can inform that generation are coming back up, I think, as I said, we're at that looking back stage for all of us. You know what I mean? It's not going to be, we're not going to get the crusade in our lifetime, much to my displeasure. And if there was one call tomorrow, I guarantee you I'd be on the plane, wherever it is, we'd do it. But it's down to them. We have to encourage them to come out of the black pillness, to come out of the culture wars of whatever they're facing up now, and trying to get them to focus on the basics, God, nation, country, and come back to that, build that family. We have to be the thought leaders in helping whatever emerging parallel markets that come on board stream and focus it into that Irish. Whether we ultimately, even for a small oil nation, separate ourselves and create an Oritania, like it's going on in South Africa, where there's segregation brought back in here, you know, back in again, because we multicultural just will not allow multiple cultures and multiple ethnicities to cohabitate along each side each other in such close proximity. It just will not work. It will not. There has to be either a separation or there has to be one dominant force in all places. And we need to encourage that ethos. And
we need to have a good relationship with these countries, basically. Just to summarize, that's the question. Like, that was, you know, you need to have we can create a good relationship with all of these places. We don't need to be meddling. We don't need to be mindlessly supporting whatever Israel wants to do in the region. We don't need to go into war with Iran. Do you know what I mean? We just need to, you need to basically, like, our nationalism is a healthy thing. Like, nationalism is sovereignty for them. Like, globalism is basically the religion that we're, the system that we're living in. And that is basically liberalism. It comes out with liberalism. Every country has to be a liberal democracy. This is a form of imperialism, and we have to look at it that way. It's an imperialism, and we can have a great relationship with all of these countries, but it doesn't mean you're going to live in our country. And they had decolonization, we can have decolonization in our countries. It's nothing personal. It's just what it is. This is our country. Go home happily, smile on your face, pat on the back. Here's 20.
And again, no malice intended in any of that rhetoric. There's no, we miss nothing but the best way, but this is unsustainable, what is being perpetrated here now. And eventually the wheels will come off. And as much as the new to the parish are brought in, I mean, they will turn if they come in the majority, they will turn and hollow out whatever's left here for their own benefit. But if we can extol in that rhetoric that we are the verbiage that we use when we're trying to reach the younger generations, to have no shame in perpetuating self-fulfillment and standing on your own two feet and looking after your own force, and people have to go and families will have to be ousted, and it's a great thing, but I'm not going to be morally upheld by that, to say that it can't happen. I like when I heard Saragon saying that when the will is there, when the will of the people is there, and we encourage enough of them to uniform, that anything can be done, anything is possible, and it will be carried out. We just simply, what happened when the state said, we're going to turn on and going to build houses for all you people, we're not going to do it for them. When the will is there, when the political will is there, anything can be achieved. And that's what I'm saying. We can decolonize our own lands ourselves. It is an impossibility. Some people say, well, they're all here now and we just got to kind of get along with it. And that's what Saragon said. Nope, they can't be returned. It can be returned and it can be done effectively without civilizational crash or civilization erasure. You just have to believe that it can and will be done.
Yeah, I agree. I would echo every word of that. It doesn't need to be barbaric. It can be done. They came here, they can leave here. Mm. It's just a matter of incentivizing and making it in their interests to leave, and I think they will. All right. And, okay, Chief Noticer said, thanks all. Thank you. Thin Red Line said, great stream. A lot of good points made by the panel. I agree. I think this has been really interesting, this stream. Dawn said, thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the great artiste said about Lady of Shalott and thanked me for the good news. Well, it wasn't me who broke. I did break the news on the Moriam stream yesterday, but it was really Dawn Browning who broke the news on Twitter. And because I wasn't really sure what to do, to be honest, but she broke it and then I retweeted that. It is very good news. I think we're all very happy that to know that Lady of Shalott is still with us. I think it's as someone said, it's a great Christmas gift for our community. And then the great artiste also said, shame that there's no Keith, but it's great to see Garrod and Gran Torino and Peter. Haven't seen them in a while. We'll check out Peter, Dawn in the future. Millennial is a great tradition, bringing folk together. Cheers, Woes. Thank you very much. That's what I want it to be. Ranulf said, great stream, guys. Possibly my favorite this millennial. I have a renewed sense of pride in my Celtic ancestry, Irish and Scottish. Great. Good. Thank you. And the great artiste then said, as an unapologetic Anglo, I say, God bless you all, you potato-loving, Guinness-soaked bastards.
Jealousy. The Irish, jealous, that's right.
The Irish are like a fruit cordial, giving way more flavor than their measure should provide.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
All right. Soaker City said, great wisdom and humor. Thank you, gents. And then Armchair Limerick Nationalist finally said, great show, lads. Thanks for the stream. Merry Christmas. What can we do better in the new year to get people on our side and get them to see the light? Well, we started off by lamenting that getting people to see the light, getting them on side, isn't enough and isn't sufficient for social change. However, assuming that it does help, at least to some degree, and I think it does, I'll ask that question to each of you. What can we do better in 2026 to spread the word? Who wants to take it first?
I'll get in and get out quick and early, and I'll keep it short and brief because I know we're coming to the end. I would just say engage, just get people to engage more, whatever their standing is, and just get them to challenge their epistemology. Just keep having the conversations and just get people to engage. You can't win the match if you're not playing.
I would say break into, like, raid, vandalize the left wing sort of movement. That's Colin looking worried there. No, don't vandalize anywhere physically. Discursively vandalize left wing sort of claims over, you know, moral high ground and helping the poor and fixing society and all of that. you know, it's totally bankrupt. So just, it's not so much fight the left, just be the left. Be the right and the left, be a hybrid. Sort of move past it and shunt them out of the way, colonize their spaces a little bit, like NGO spaces. I had an experience of doing that a little bit a few months ago. I haven't talked about that publicly yet. I went along to a meeting and sort of interrupted it a little bit. Not,
are you coming out there, Garrett? Is this the
it wasn't one, one, it wasn't one like that. It was actually a neutrality thing.
Oh,
it was a, same, so it wasn't that thing. That's what I'm talking. It was like a left neutrality. Yeah. Somewhere by. Yeah. No, it was a neutrality thing, which is something that that appeals to like a lot of people. I went along to it and I nodded and smiled for a while. And then I started asking questions, you know, saying it should be a broad tent, and it turned into a little bit of an argy bargy. It was interesting, but there should be maybe more of that, you know, sort of, I regret using the word vandalizing because that was peaceful, but it's kind of, you know, encroaching on that sort of
Sassoon. Why not Sassoon their institutions and take them over?
A little bit. Their meetings, their stuff. Go along and say, I'm not trying to ruin the thing or whatever, but it's a public meeting, isn't it? Can I make my point? And suddenly half the crowd, which is what I experienced, were like, yeah. You know, don't be afraid to kind of get in there. I agree with Don, writing Substacks or even writing books. I like the idea that you just pour all your thoughts into a book. You say, the algorithm, Elon Musk, sloppyism, they can't take that from me. They're my genuine thoughts. I am a person. I am conscious. And these words are real more than posting every day, which I'm sort of tired of. Reaching out and connecting with people in real life, I think is good too. But beyond that, I don't know. That'll be my prescription. And I'm applying that. I'm like suggesting that to myself as well, because it's hard to kind of do these things. But I think those are positive approaches. Get out of the churn, the daily churn of one post or one Candace Owens to the next, and actually try to distill your ideas, your analysis of society into a coherent, real view, and expand it out beyond the I'm a right-wing online person world. Try to think broadly of everyone, you know? So,
like a human being.
Yes.
And I agree. Right, first of all, what you just said there, often advice is really for oneself. I mean, I think that happens again and again, at least for me. I find myself saying things and I think, really, it's you that you're talking to, Colin. But yeah, I also agree about Substack. That it's something that I've really found since sort of switching to Substack, is that there's this sense of freedom and fresh air that I don't need to be talking about the week's events anymore. I can think in a more long-term way. It's so liberating. It really is. And at the same time, I feel like now I can afford to get back into talking about more current affairs stuff because I'm mostly in that headspace of Substack. Peter, what can we do in better in 2026 to better reach the public?
Well, yeah, I concur with all the lads have said there. That those are very good points. And I suppose what I'm going to say is that, like I said earlier, this kind of populist thing that's happening now is a body without a head. And in order to basically direct that body, you have to become the head. And so that means that there is a job of work that has to be done. Okay. And that is, it has all kinds of aspects. There's media, there's new media, citizen journalism. There is, you know, intellectual work that has to be done. And there's activism and there's political parties. And all of this has to build towards basically creating a new elite of a sort. Okay. So I'm not afraid of the idea of an elite. I think every society that stands has an elite. There's always going to be an elite. And what you have to do is you have to ensure that you produce the knowledge, you produce the ideas, you construct your analysis, you tie your analysis to historical, your own culture, you tie it to the historical ideas that form the West. And if you have a theory of history, a theory of politics, and all the rest of it, if you are coherent, if you have created a coherent movement around that, that is how you basically obtain political power. Knowledge production is the first step towards political power. And if you do that effectively, you will. It's just inevitable. And that's what I would say to people is start writing and get into a habit of reading and get out. Like Garrow was saying, get off the churn, get out of being, because your thoughts are someone else's on social media. You know, it's one of the things I miss about the old alt-right days was that it was very much cerebral in many respects. Maybe too much. Maybe it got a bit wanky, whatever. But the thing was, you always felt like you were being challenged. You know, I was challenged with things that people have said on streams, and it forced me to kind of think, well, you know, maybe I am a bit of a liberal still. You know, maybe I'm being too, you know, because I have that in me. Like, I know I have that in me. I'm quite liberal in some respects. You know what I mean? I have this, like, leave people alone type thing. But
I used to be like that too, and then I grew up, and now I'm full on massification. Get up there! They must go home!
Ironically, sorry, go ahead. No, but that's it. Yeah, that's the message. You know, you have to take in charge your own development as an individual. You become an active participant in knowledge production, and seek to elevate your people and yourself, basically. And that is, there's an elite required now. And there's all these people who are desperate for someone to lead them. That's what's going on with the populist thing. People are crying out to be led. And so you can become those people, you know. That's what my message.
Very good.
Okay. And also Ghost Dog Man said, thank you for the stream. Thank you very much. And I'll end with this optimistic super chat. Not super chat, just a comment in the live chat from Odeon. And he said, the left, and this is why I think that we should be optimistic, and here's a good summation of why. The left is eating itself with Zionism, transgenderism, and the Muslim bloc breaking away to start their own parties and organizations. Exactly. That worldview that we've been battling for the last 10, 15 years is disintegrating in front of our eyes. Because you can't square these contradictions, supporting transgenderism while supporting mass immigration from the third world, because they're not going to be sympathetic, supporting Islam while supporting Zionism. You can't square that. It's just completely contradictory and at odds with itself. So I think that should encourage us. And as I said earlier, we're fighting something that's internally contradictory. We're also fighting something that is totally unnatural. So let's end with that note, because I think that's reason for optimism. Okay, well, this has been great. So thank you very much, Garode, Gran Torino, and Peter from The Receipts. Very good debut on Millennial, by the way. Somebody said that in the live chat. So thanks for appearing. All right, this has been good. Thanks very much. I'll be back in an hour with the Australasian banquet. But in the meantime, this has been a really good showing from the Emerald Isle. So thank you very much. And I'll see you all later.
God bless.
Thank you.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.